Welcome to the Thursday, December 15th Planning and Zoning Commission's special public hearing. May we call the meeting? Can we get a roll call, please, Mrs. Secretary?
Yes. Mr. Tuohy.
Here.
I am here. Ms. Lowe.
Here.
Mr. Harder.
Here.
Right, going on here again. Mr. Stanton. Mr. Strodman.
Yes.
Ms. Rushing.
Yes.
Ms. Russell.
Here.
Mr. McMahon.
Present.
We have eight. We have a quorum.
Thank you, Mrs. Burns. Approval of agenda. Mr. Zinner, is there any changes to our lengthy agenda?
No, there is not.
Thank you, sir. With that, we'll go ahead and get started with our case 16-110, which is a request by the City of Columbia to adopt a unified development code governing subdivision and land use regulations throughout the City of Columbia's corporate limits, as requested by the City Council and supported by the City's 2013 comprehensive plan entitled Columbia Imagined, the plan for how we live and grow. The UDC will replace Chapter 20, Chapter 23, Chapter 25, and Chapter 29 of the existing City Code. It will also amend Chapter 12A by relocating the provisions of Article 3 into a single document. So how we're going to work this evening is we'll go ahead and open it up to the public input portion of our meeting tonight. As you came in, there was a sheet of paper on on the desk back there with some kind of some procedures that we'll follow tonight. So in case you didn't pick one of those up, I'll quickly summarize it for you. Basically, in a nutshell, during the open public input portion, you'll state your name and address for the record. We're going to ask everybody a maximum of 5 minutes, and you cannot, obviously, we could waive, you know, we may ask you at some point to stop even before 5 minutes is up, if there's reason for such, but you'll have 5 minutes max. You cannot split your time up amongst other people here this evening. You can't use 3 minutes and give 2 minutes to someone else. You only get to speak once. And really the purpose of tonight is to speak on specific segments or specific topics within the UDC that you have a concern about or you're questioning or you want us to discuss a little bit more. We're not here really to discuss the if you don't believe that this is the right that we're the whole UDC is not right for Columbia, and that's not why we're here. That's already been moved up forward. We've been asked to review this. That's what we're doing. If you have an overall global planning point of view, I would ask that you would hold that till City Council. And if you have specific items on a segment, that's what we want to talk about this evening. Obviously, we'd love not to have repeat people. And if you are going to repeat something, maybe just really quickly say, I don't like XYZ and not go into a lot of detail maybe, and we'll get that on record. Hypothetical scenarios are tough to deal with. So, and everything else is pretty standard. So, with that, Mr. Zinner, where are you going? Mr. McMahon? Yes, sir.
We lack a translator, don't we?
Oh. I can't say yes. Well, anybody know how to do sign language?
Not well enough.
Mark Farnan, you know sign language?
Only one.
Yeah, and that's not the sign we're looking for.
and we thank Mr. Farnan for that. We do.
Is that okay? I mean,
we'll have to proceed forward. Why don't you begin and let me find out if we have one coming.
Okay. So with that, we'll go ahead and I guess we're at this point we're ready to open it up to public input. So I'll go ahead and open the public input portion of this evening. And so come on up and don't be shy. Let me get my watch going first. Mr. Farnan, we started your time as soon as you stood up. Just joking.
I will be brief.
We didn't.
My name is Mark Farnan, 103 East Brandon, Columbia, Missouri. I have a short presentation that I do need to... Um, This is a specific issue that relates to the regulating plan map that has been proposed. And I think there are several people who have commented on this at different times. And this is an effort to, I think, address and correct the map. If you see on the exhibit, there is a piece of property at the corner of Broadway and Providence Road that's owned by Dan Hagen. And on this regulating plan map, it shows an alley that bisects that block. Actually, that alley does not exist. It was vacated by ordinance on July 1st, 1963, by the City Council. That vacation of that alley was then further referenced when the city asked for additional right-of-way at that stubbed corner so that you could make a right turn off of Providence, Broadway onto Providence. At that time, that document also acknowledged, yes, that alley has been vacated and was done so in 1963. So since that is not an alley, and since the process to correct the regulating plan map can be cumbersome and you would have to go and ask for a change to that regulating map, I would ask that that be eliminated in this instance and not drawn as such so it would not be enforced as such in the future. Every other map that we can find is accurate right now. This is the assessor's map, and if you look at the red line that goes, that bisects that property, the property lines for the Dan Hagen property and the properties to the north are adjacent and contiguous, and it shows no alley like it does across Providence. In the next block, you can see there's two red lines and it shows an alley. This one, it's right, and so we would ask that the map be changed. On the advice of staff, we needed to ask for an amendment for that to be done. It shouldn't be done administratively. We should do an amendment. So I would ask one of you good-looking people to do that for us, please. I'll conclude my remarks pretty quickly here. I want to thank you all. This has been a really, really, really difficult process, and it has been remarkably time-consuming. And this is a hard way to make new friends, but I feel like I've gotten to know you all pretty well. I think that you have done a good job, and I think you have approached this with fairness and with respect to the people of this community in terms of trying to get it right. I don't agree with everything that you have done. And in particular, I think that we have, I think that we didn't do it right in terms of the neighborhood protection standards that have been adopted. The part that I don't like is that there's not a safety valve for people who own property in those areas who did buy it as an R3 property and may now face some restriction on that use, including the fact that your own property could be used against you. And if you own two properties and one has a single-family house on it and you want to do something with the next-door one, your own property is invoked and there's no remedy. There's no way to not do that because then that becomes the rule. I wish that there could be something adopted. I know that you discussed grandfathering and didn't like that idea. I know that you discussed maybe it just goes on zoning, not use, and that was not approved. I wish it were. I wish that we could say maybe something else like if a property is going to be identified as a single family, then it needs to be owner-occupied, not a rental, because why would we protect a rental against other rentals if that's what was next to it? Or on the C3, I think the landscaping is fine, but I don't think that the but not giving a property owner the ability to have an automatic way to get out of it, whether it's agreement with the neighbor, whatever it is, I wish you would reconsider that stuff. I think it's a question of fairness, and I think that you could still maintain the intent of the rule. We do this all over town in different ways. Sometimes we call it an overlay. Sometimes we call it subdivision rules. But I wish you would really reconsider that at some point before this goes forward to the council. Thank you very much for your hard work. I appreciate it, and I would be happy to answer any questions about any line in the code. I have read it.
I think that's a challenge, commissioners. Commissioners, any questions for the speaker? Mr. McMahon.
Quick question of Mr. Farnan and a question for staff, and then a procedural question. I have three questions. Mr. Farnan, the assessor's map is from what year?
That is the
that's the current
currently on the Boone County Assessor's website.
Thank you. Mr. Zenner, are the facts as Mr. Farnan presents them to the best of your knowledge?
They are. We have actually had them presented by Dan Simon's office, attorney at law. I would have cut Mr. Farnan off so he could have saved his 5 minutes. We are aware of this. It is an oversight on our part, unbeknownst to Farrell Madden when they prepared the regulating plan, that this alley was formally vacated. The ordinance was attached in the documentation provided to us from Mr. Simon's office. Irrefutable evidence that, in fact, this is not an alley. It is private property at this point and is to be removed from the regulating plan as such, given its location to the intersection.
Thank you, Manager Zenner. With that question in mind, I have a question for the chair and a question for Mr. Zenner. As this is a bit abnormal, and if we were to move to amend this, when would we make that amendment?
This evening, once
later on this evening.
Yes, sir.
All right, thank you.
Once the public input portion is closed. Any additional questions for this speaker?
Mr. Farnan, I just want to thank you for your comments, and I couldn't agree more with the neighborhood protection issues. And as you know, we've brought this up repeatedly and unfortunately have not found a resolution to this.
You still got a chance.
I agree with that.
All right. Thank you all for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Farnan.
Good evening. My name is Tim Wade. I reside at 2104 Bluff Point Drive. I'd like to load up a presentation, please. So I'd like to piggyback off of what Mr. Farnan indicated about neighborhood protection standards. This is a picture of East Campus, and the black area is the group I represent, the East Campus majority. That's the 212 parcel owners that have signed my petition. The white area, which is basically east of Ann, is the parcels that are resident owned. So you're looking at a black area that dominates the East Campus Neighborhood Association. Those little white specks in the middle of the black sea, those are some resident owned properties in the middle of R3. So basically that entire black area is R3 zoned. And we're going to be dictated to by R1 sprinkled throughout there, not very much at all. So we really need some property protection standards, not neighborhood protection, but property protection standards. Now, I realize you just talked about this on Monday, so I'd like to make some proposals. The current neighborhood protection standards apply only to lots that are other than R1 and R2, so it's very repressive or punishing to R3 properties. This is going to hurt the facilitation of student housing in East Campus. It targets mom-and-pop property managers like myself, not the big corporations who I think a lot of people prefer to take their frustrations out on out-of-town corporations. This zoning, the neighborhood protection standards that you've given me or us, they're not simpler and fairer, but they're just more complex and more unjust to R3 property owners. So when you think about protection for people like myself who own R3 property in East Campus, we don't have the normal protection that most people in Columbia would have. Like most neighborhoods have property protection through their everyone's R1 zone. So everybody applies themselves to a homeowners association, the covenants and architectural controls. But, you know, the area that I represent is R3 properties. We have no homeowners association, so we have this overlay. So what I would like to see is perhaps an amendment to neighborhood protection standards, particularly the applicability. I want to protect my R3 property, but I also want to protect any R1 home anywhere in town. And so basically the applicability of neighborhood protection standards would apply to all lots within an urban conservation overlay district only if that overlay language itself is amended to accept these standards. Otherwise, the neighborhood protection standards do not apply to lots within an urban conservation overlay district. So we would more than likely not adopt those neighborhood protection standards in the East Campus majority area. Some of the other amendments that I would propose is you're doubly repressing R3 property owners like myself in East Campus by subjecting us to multiple layers of protection, the 29-2.8 MC District Dimensional Standards Summary and Neighborhood Protection Standards. It's like a double whammy. That's repressive. So to preserve the language that you already have in there, you know, just go ahead and keep the amendments or the language that you already have in that 29-4.8 to all lots in RMF districts that contain principal use. In other words, just add these two sections, these two points that say, hey, if these people in this urban conservation overlay want to opt out of these neighborhood protection standards, they can. All right. But it still applies to everybody else throughout the city if they have R1 property. It's just repressive, very repressive. And as Mark Farnan indicated, it could be done better. This is one way to protect everyone, including people like myself. If you take a look at that picture one more time, you see a neighborhood that is predominantly R3, subjected to the whims of the few. And that's exactly what's going to happen here in East Campus. And we're going to move student development somewhere other than East Campus, probably downtown. And I think that's the opposite of what you're looking to do. So any questions? Thank you for your time.
Commissioners, are there any questions for the speaker? I see none. Thank you, Mr. Wade.
Good evening, Caleb Colbert, 601 East Broadway. I just have a couple of comments to follow up on that have been addressed before, but I just wanted to bring these to the commission's attention again. First, I represent the Barbara Altus Trust. The trust owns the property at 1005 Cherry Street. You can see it there pictured in the middle of the screen. I want to address the core height overlay. This was the one of the original regulating plans. You'll see that property was completely included in the core height overlay. In other words, the entire property could be built to 10 stories. In the most recent version of the regulating plan, that core height area cuts the Altus Trust property in a third and two-thirds. And so we would ask this commission to extend that core height overlay to the west edge of Hitt Street, at least for that block. That makes it consistent with the urban storefront building form standard along Broadway, and that seems like a clean break for the transition from 10 stories to 6 stories. South of the property is the city parking garage, so it would have a minimal impact on adjacent properties if you move that to the east. So I did propose some language here to fix that particular issue. Second item I want to talk about was the MDT boundary along St. James. The problem, as I see it, is we exclude property that's currently zoned C2 while including property that is zoned M1. Mr. Ott owns properties that are located along Ash Street and St. James. You can see under the current zoning, they're zoned C2. He also owns the two lots directly north of the C2 property that's zoned M1. The history on that C2, on those C2 parcels, they were rezoned to C2 in 2008. At that time, that rezoning had the support of the neighborhood, it had the support of the city council, and it passed unanimously. in the current regulating plan, we've carved out the existing C2, which sort of leaves it in limbo. So at a minimum, we're asking that that be brought back into the MDT district. That would be consistent with the zoning that was approved and has been in place now since 2008. Additionally, you'll see that the M1 that is west of St. James is brought into the MDT district. We would respectfully suggest that with that in mind, it makes sense to include the industrial property north of the C2 zoning also into the MDT district so that you have zoning that's consistent along St. James. So essentially, we're asking for that boundary line to be moved to allow the properties on the east of St. James to be in the MDT district. Again, that's the language I would suggest adopting. And with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Commissioners, any questions for this speaker? I see none. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Yes, my name is Paul Sharp, 1814 Cliff Drive. I come to speak in favor of the neighborhood protections in the UDO. I'm also a treasurer of the East Campus Neighborhood Association, and so I maintain the roles of the East Campus Neighborhood Association, and it is highly dominated by residents and not property owners. Living in the East Campus Neighborhood Association, I really feel that we do need some protection, that there is just a continuing encroachment of rentals into the area, and we just at times feel powerless to do anything about some of the losses of houses in the area and the large apartment buildings that have been built in the area. That's all I wanted to say.
Commissioners, questions for the speaker? Mr. Sharp, how long have you lived in your home?
25 years.
So you've been there for through the whole process?
Yes.
With the overlay? I see no additional questions, so thank you, Mr. Sharp.
Good evening. Peter Norgard, 1602 Hinkson Avenue. Start out by saying the stated intent of the UDC section 29.4.8 is to preserve residential neighborhood character of established homes within multifamily districts and adjacent to mixed-use or special zoning districts. I believe an unstated goal, but one that underlies the entirety of this whole discussion, is that the protection standards are an effort essentially to effect greater balance between what those that live in a particular neighborhood would like to see and what the redevelopment community, particularly in the central city area, would like to see. I'll say that I believe out-of-scale redevelopment is inconsistent with the stated goals of preservation, particularly within neighborhoods such as Benton Stevens or, you know, even East Campus, established neighborhoods. Out-of-scale developments typically benefit the redeveloper. However, they do impact the dynamic of the communities that they occur in. And typically, they have perceived negative impacts on those neighborhoods, particularly lots that are immediately adjacent to some of these redevelopments. Further increased parking stress is measurable and often negative to the characteristics of the neighborhood, and in particular to older neighborhoods where subdivision occurred before cars even existed. I'm going to convey a few comments from Ms. Janet Hammond, who was unable to be here tonight. I would like to see some additional language inserted into subsection B, paragraph 2 of 29-4.8 on the applicability of protection standards to not only include RMF development adjacent to R1 and R2 zoned lots, but to lots that are used as R1 or R2. Despite their zoning. So, for instance, a lot of central city neighborhoods, most central city neighborhoods, in fact, are zoned R3. However, a great majority of homes within those neighborhoods are actually used as single-family residences, and I believe some of those people deserve greater protections than the currently written code would provide. And I would say it's a subtle difference, but it's important to the overall quality of life, particularly those homeowners who are landlocked in a sea of R3 use or soon to be RMF use. I would like to see the inclusion of a median setback standard for all buildings on one side of a block within which redevelopment cannot encroach. There is some concern that redevelopment creep will gradually push lots towards the front lot line. And, you know, the less aggressive 25-foot standard doesn't correct for that necessarily. They can encroach further than 25 feet. Obviously, it won't creep all the way to the edge, but, you know, there's plenty of lots that are far, far set back from the street. And so to put a redevelopment in a neighborhood such as that where lots are really deep has a visual impact on the appearance of the neighborhood. And I believe the people that live in those homes, again, deserve some additional protections. I would like to see modification of the existing building height standards, subsection D, to require architectural gradation, otherwise known as stepping down, any portion of a building within 25 feet of the rear side lots to a maximum height of only 24 feet. And I would also like to see an increase in side and rear setbacks, an additional 10 feet beyond what's normally required. You know, building height necessarily impacts the appearance of a neighborhood. Therefore, it impacts the character of the neighborhood, which is the purpose, you know, neighborhood protection standards are there to protect the character. So without these kinds of controls, we feel that neighborhoods won't be adequately protected. I'd like to see the inclusion of an entirely new section, subsection, to address the issue of density and scale. I'd like to see buildings in the RMF district occupy no more than 100 feet of lot frontage and have a roof peak no greater than 35 feet. In addition, any zoning districts that abut against an R1 or R2 or RMF district must meet the design standards and guidelines spelled out in Section 29.4.7. And then the final thing that she wanted me to convey is that she would like to see the burden for providing additional parking in RMF districts increased to the extent that parking areas on the side of lots are not permitted, specifically an RMF district adjoins, when an RMF district adjoins an R1 or R2 zoned lot, or if the use of the lot is R1 or R2, off-street parking provisions should be made at the rear of the structure. Obviously, this matter could be challenged at a Board of Adjustments hearing, but permitting side lots to exist is detrimental to the character of most neighborhoods and is a practice that many of us do not like. Can I finish?
Sorry.
Okay.
I let you start then, everybody, you know.
Sorry.
Commissioners, questions for the speaker?
I've got a question.
Mr. Tuohy.
So you've heard the concerns from the other property owners.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there's any middle ground to help give them a remedy to solve their problems?
I do, but honestly, so single-family residences, particularly in this part of the neighborhoods, don't necessarily have the means or the time to defend themselves against the development community, which often has people that do this full-time for their job. And so, yes, there's a middle ground, but I just don't see how we can reach a middle ground, because every time we ask for something, it's shot down as being overly aggressive or detrimental or draconian or whatever your choice word is.
Well, but if we could put a middle ground in this code,
mm-hmm.
what do you think that middle ground is then?
Well, I think the acceptance of certain of these standards and the you know, letting some of them go and letting some of them stay. Some of the suggestions on their side, I can understand their point of view. My wife is a landowner, and she rents out places, and we have a vested interest in this as well, but we also are part of a community, so I don't know how. It's difficult to balance, in my opinion, when both sides are unwilling to hear each other. And to this date, I haven't really heard either side see eye to eye on particular or specifics, if you understand what I'm saying.
Mr. Order.
quite a few on the list. If you could pick one or maybe just a certain segment that you thought was the most important, what would you consider it to be?
I personally think the insertion of the zoning, the applicability standards, zoning use versus actual zoning, use versus zoning. So parcels that are zoned RMF may be used as R1. I feel that those deserve some protections. And I don't feel that it would be a major burden on the city to determine whether a lot is being used R1 or R3 or, you know.
Ms. Lowe, excuse me.
Mr. Norgaard, that's actually one of the points you made I was confused by, because currently the neighborhood protection standards do apply to any lot in RMF that contains a use other than single-family or two-family dwelling. So it's protecting any RMF that is used as one or two-family.
Well, that's so great. I'm conveying Ms. Hammond's comments.
Okay. I believe that already is addressed. So, all right. Thank you.
Any additional questions? Mr. Zinner.
Mr. Norgaard, will we have the opportunity to have Ms. Hammond's most recent comments?
Because mm-hmm.
they do not appear to match with what was distributed to us.
Okay, I may have the older version.
The 11th version from December 11th, number 2, is the version that my understanding is what you may have been reading from. However, the additional height restrictions do not refer to a maximum building height to the peak of the roof. That's why I'm asking. We may have competing comments that Ms. Hammond's making.
Well, I think she had concerns about redevelopments where the height standard was measured at the eave, and then there's a, you know, 12 additional feet of roof height.
The density and scale comment that you read from the new section that she would like to have added
mm-hmm.
does not give any indication of maximum roof peak height. It refers to a 412 pitch as the maximum. So whatever you're reading from, I'd like to just have a record of so we can provide that for public comment or review.
I'm reading from comments that I shared with Ms. Hammond, so I don't have a document of that.
Okay.
Any additional questions? I see none. Thank you, Mr. Norgaard.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Julie Walden, Vice Chair of the Disability Commission, and I composed a letter from the commission to you guys dated November 18th. And I'm here to answer any questions you might have of the letter. If you don't have the letter in your first year recollection, because it was a month ago, I can read it to you.
Commissioners, we did receive your letter for clarity. Commissioners, any questions? From the information that we received from Mrs. Walton earlier? I see none. So thank you for your letter.
Good evening. My name is Sidel Carson. I'm at 4802 Maple Leaf Drive. I'm here on behalf of Tompkins Homes and Development, owned by Mike Tompkins. He was unable to be here this evening. There are a few topics that I would like to bring to your attention. The first can be found in Chapter 29, 4.5, C11D, regarding climax forest and tree preservation. The requirement that the 25% of preservation be reserved as a common lot reduces the number of lots available and puts the burden of maintenance on the homeowners association. Also, the requirement that the 25% of preservation exclude the trees within the stream buffer is, in our opinion, somewhat excessive. We would propose that the 25% preservation requirement be allowed anywhere on the property rather than on common lots. and that it can be protected with a conservation easement. In addition, we would propose allowing the 25% preservation requirement to include those already in the stream buffer. Next, I would like to address time constraints for a preliminary plat found in Chapter 29.5.3. Under current regulations, a developer has up to 7 years to develop any percentage of a preliminary plat. The new standards would change that to requiring 1/3 of a plan be developed within 3 years from approval. We feel this is unreasonable, particularly for large tracts. It simply does not give the developer enough time to do the work necessary. This includes utilities, design, permits, road construction, and et cetera. We feel it would benefit the city as a whole to be able to look at a longer range plan rather than rushing the development to meet the 3-year time constraint. We would propose that if 1/3 of the development is to be completed, the time frame be increased to the current standards of 7 years. Finally, I would like to address the number of entrances for subdivisions as noted in Chapter 29.4.3. Currently, subdivisions are able to have up to 99 lots before a second entrance is required. This allows developers to plan plats accordingly and construct additional entrances within the planned timeline. At this time, Boone County allows up to 50 homes per entrance, and the new standards of 30 homes per entrance as proposed in the UDC would hinder the neighborhood design process and would not allow the best use of the land design. We would propose that if the current standards of 99 homes is considered unacceptable, and we do understand that it was referenced from the fire code, that the city at least match the current county standards and allow 50 homes per entrance. And that's all I have.
Commissioners, speakers of this guest, Mr. McMahon.
Ma'am, thank you. It might have been communicated, and my fellow commissioners can help me out, but on the preliminary plats, we set it at 3 years, allowed a 1-year extension, and lowered the 1/3 requirement to 1/4. Did I catch all of that amendment that we did? And an additional request can be made beyond that if a hardship is bearing.
Okay. I thought that was the information I had.
All right. I just wanted to get that on the record in case someone wasn't clear. Thank you.
Additional questions, commissioners? I see none. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Katie Essing with the Downtown CID, and we submitted a letter to you already, so I wanted to offer a chance to answer any questions. A few things were already brought up by Caleb and Mark Farnan, but we did have a few questions on the open space, if we'd like to discuss that more. And then an overall question is on the quarter block exemption, and sounds as though we may have been interpreting this incorrectly. So if I could ask Mr. Zinner to just clarify that 100-foot facade.
Yes, as it relates to the first point in Ms. Essing's letter to the commission on the quarter block exemption, it was referring to exempting lots sized smaller than 17,100 square feet. Typically a downtown quarter block for expansions not exceeding 75% of coverage of a parcel or for properties on the National Register of Historic Places. As we've indicated, and I believe we have previously discussed, National Historic Register of Places, national designation does not result in any additional regulatory process for the City of Columbia. You have to be within a defined HP overlay for such additional regulatory standards to be identified during our building permitting process that may impact properties. However, there is a provision within the code that does deal with an exemption as it relates to facade composition. It is on page 184 of the code under paragraph 2, facade composition, item number IV. Roman numeral number 4, that says individual infill projects on lots with a street frontage less than 100 feet on a block face are exempt from the overall facade composition requirements for that block face but shall include a functioning street entry door, which would be no different than any of our other projects. So the facade composition components of that that would be required for baying and window placement and differentiation are all addressed through that exemption, which I believe would take care of the concern that has been raised by the CID that there may be overly onerous requirements placed upon small lots that are seeking to redevelop or as an infill project. So a full teardown rebuild that has less than 100 feet of frontage would be exempt from those facade requirements. However, if it is on a road on a street frontage, it would need to meet those building form standards that are defined either as the urban general or the urban shop front. So you'd still have particular design requirements that may apply in those instances based on the specific building form standard, but the facade composition requirements that would also apply in those building form standards would be exempt by that provision.
That does help a lot, thank you. And I think our main concern was protecting those unique infill redevelopments downtown and the small developments. So thank you for that clarification. For the open space question, we're just reading into the details. It has gotten much better with the changes that you guys have made. And we just want to clarify how much has to be on that bottom floor and what would apply. For example, at 10th and Broadway, we've got the nice new development that's going to have Medici Pizza on the bottom. And would that count as open space? Or like a Harold's Donut example where you've got retail on the bottom level, and would that apply? If not, we'd like to propose that you can meet more of that open space above ground level through things like the rooftop decks and the balcony and that kind of thing, because some of those lots, that open space may have to be in an alley that may not be as appealing for the user. And then one last, and I don't think we've talked about this yet, is that parking setback line of 24 feet, which could be quite large in the downtown area. Recommend that be changed to 4 to 6 feet. That would be similar to the lot at 8th and Cherry near Bank of America. So maybe it's been covered and we missed it, but the 24 feet seems really large for downtown. And I think that was all of the comments that weren't covered by other speakers.
Commissioners, any questions for the speaker? Ms. Lowe?
I was just wondering if staff wanted to respond to Ms. Essing's questions about where open space may be provided on upper floors and if retail space could be counted. And then the parking setback line, I'd have to check. So
I believe we have adjusted the parking setback line, provided landscaping is provided consistent with the landscape strip or landscape buffer requirements that are already defined within the code. So that issue has been adjusted. I believe that was reflected in the errata sheet, so I'll have to go back and look. I believe we've addressed the issue of open space. It does not apply to any building that does not have residential development in it, and it only applies to buildings that have more than 4 units of residential. So unless I am incorrect, Ms. Lowe, this was something that I believe we worked on extensively. So and that open space can be located anywhere within the building now.
Okay, because we were reading, it looked like it might still be 67% on the ground floor level, but it can all be up above.
Those graphics, the graphics that reflect the private open space area that are in the MDT will be amended accordingly.
Okay.
And they are all being unitized as well to the appropriate percentage of landscaped area or open space criteria.
I believe the statement I would look at is private or open space may be located on any floor.
Okay.
Or any combination of floors, meaning it can be split up in any way, or any location on the lot. So we were trying to clarify it could be located in the setbacks or in any of those areas.
Okay.
Basically, it's all open.
We appreciate that. We just wanted to clarify that.
Provided
that
it
intent.
Is accessible to all residents or tenants of the building.
Okay,
that's the only requirement.
And I believe that is in the errata sheet because I recall.
I was reading from the errata sheet.
And thank you, because I unfortunately didn't make my copy of it. I don't have it up right now. That is the reconsolidated open space standard that we did move actually toward the front of the MDT requirement. So as an individual is reading MDT and looking at what the requirements are, they are no longer embedded in the building form standards. Open space is now covered as a freestanding item under a previous heading, as a matter of fact. So it made more sense for a reader to be able to read it all at the beginning of the code. It will actually apply on page, the revision, the revised text will be actually placed under paragraph number 7, which is on page 188 of the code, the public hearing draft of the code. And that new standard, new language, is actually within the errata sheet itself. The parking setback modification also was addressed as an acknowledgement to larger parcels that may be split. So this deals with the overall street wall requirement. It was the alternative to the street wall to where if you did not build out your entire development site, let's for instance say you had a 100-foot long parcel and you only wanted to do an infill building of 50 feet in your first phase, you would, by the way that the code was originally written, you'd be required to put a street wall up. We have revised that section, or the commission has proposed revision to that to allow for a screening buffer to be installed on the unimproved portion of the site. As long as it is not being utilized as a parking area initially, and that then allows it to come forward. And even with a parking lot installation, you could pull the parking forward with the screening to be more similar to what the Boone County National Bank or Bank of America parking lot is there at 8th and Cherry.
Commissioners, any additional questions for the speaker? Thank you, Mrs. Essing.
Again, I'll thank all of you for your work and hours. It's very much appreciated. Thank you.
Paul Land, residence at 4104 Jocelyn Court. Want to make sure I've got that right on that parking setback for downtown. The request, I understand from the CID, is to reduce it from 24 feet to 6 feet. I want to help make sure I understand that that was done. It's hard for me to follow all this errata sheet. It's got the word air in it, sounds like to me. But I want confirmation on that.
It has only been amended, Mr. Land, in the instance in where you meet the criteria by allowing it to be pulled forward. And if I recall correctly, it is still a absolute as it relates to our two frontages on 9th and Broadway. That parking setback line is not modifiable for a parking area. If it is not a developed parking area, it is just open space. You are not required to put in the street wall. You have the option of landscape treatment.
And it is reduced from 24 feet to 6 feet.
In the instance where you are not using it for a parking area, that is correct. You can put that landscape treatment within the 6-foot landscape strip.
What about a lot that's being used for a parking lot?
Pardon me?
A lot that will be used for a parking lot, a platted lot that will be used for parking surface.
I'd have to look. We can provide you that answer before the evening is done.
Okay, that's fine. I'm advocating for the reduction from 24 feet to 6. Thank you.
Any questions, Mr. McMahon?
Thank you, Mr. Land. I had a question for the chair. I apologize.
Oh, okay.
Could you direct our speakers to elevate the microphone to their mouth or vice versa? I'm having a little bit of a hard time.
Gotcha.
Thank you.
Thank you for that.
I'm Clyde Bentley, and I live in a historical home at 1863 Cliff Drive in the East Campus area. And if I had my way, we would have no zoning at all. We would just have builders and residents who agreed upon a look and feeling for a city and got along and produced cities that we could all live in. Unfortunately, that's not been the case in many times. In another life, I spent many, many hours at zoning meetings, planning commission meetings, and city council meetings. And I really respect what you've done, because I've seen this work before, and I know that this is difficult, because zoning is not for the individual. Zoning is for the community and for society. It's because the individuals can't do this themselves, that we have zoning to get together. I think you've done a good job of trying to get this. I would love to see our developers be able to zone, build projects in East Campus that fit in with this unique atmosphere that you see in almost every university city in the United States, where you have neighborhoods like this that have a special character that we try to protect. I am, for that reason, in favor of the neighborhood protection plans, because I think it's an attempt. It's not a perfect attempt, but I think you've done a good job of trying to make this work and give us neighborhoods that do have an atmosphere that we can all like, that improve property values as they go up. And Mr. Tui, you asked about a middle ground. There is a middle ground. I think it's one you've tried to avoid, and that's architectural review. If we had buildings and developments that did maintain the character of a community, I don't think there would be a problem no matter what the zoning is. That's a very difficult thing to do, and the alternative is to try to do it through zoning. And it's an imperfect attempt, but I think you've done a good job. And I would hope that you would just stick to your guns, not let property line creep, move things out, and just kind of see if we can come up with a city that we can all love as we do. So thank you.
Commissioners, is there any questions for the speaker? I see none. Thank you, Mr. Bailey.
Good evening. First, I'm Dave Griggs. I have had a business in City Limits of Columbia for over 46 years. I've worked in the City of Columbia. And I live at 6420 North Highway VV. Tonight, I'm wearing my economic development hat, and this is more of an expression of a concern that may need to be addressed because I'm frankly confused. The old code, Section 20-1, lists a permanent use in District M1, industrial, clearly states manufacturing and processing. I have a packet of all this information for you if you'd like. And a conditional use is clearly stated in Section 20.3 as manufacturer compounding or processing of hazardous materials. Interesting what hazardous materials might be, but nonetheless. This new draft on page 29 lists heavy industry, the processing, manufacturing, or storage of products under potentially hazardous conditions, such as the creation of products from extracted raw materials. Interesting or confusing definition. And the use of flammable or explosive materials. This may include but not be limited to concrete plants, electroplating works, forges, galvanizing works, sheet metal shops, and other similar uses. But I would suggest that heavy manufacturing might be 3M, Schneider, I think is how you pronounce it, Electric, perhaps Kraft Foods, American Air Filters, and other concerns. In the new draft on page 134 from the September public hearing of 2016, footnote 444, which refers to heavy industry that is listed purely as a conditional use in MC, M1, and MU with a footnote of 379, says, combines current asphaltic concrete plants, electroplating works, forges, galvanizing works, manufacture compounding of hazardous materials, monument and dimensional stoneworks, photo engraving, planing mills, plumbing and sheet metal shops, and my real point, plants and facilities. I would suggest that probably my business, which is a retail business, could be considered a plant or facility because we do some things. Certainly, 3M, Kraft Foods, etc., are plants and facilities, and should, at least if that's the current interpretation, I strongly urge that not to be a conditional use. We are working today with two significant companies who want to locate significant investment and job creation in Columbia, Missouri. And I would tell you, if I went to them and said, oh, by the way, we're changing our zoning code to make your food processing plant, manufacturing plant, distribution center a conditional use, and you have to go to the city council to get permission to even site your lot, and divulge to your competitors all the competitive information that you've worked on for 6 months and give them a year's lead time to combat what you're trying to do, it's just not, I don't think we intend to do that. If in fact it needs to be a conditional use, it needs to go to the Board of Adjustment and not through council, but it should not be those companies, that kind of investment should not be a conditional use. It should be a permitted use. I have absolutely no problem if somebody's compounding dynamite or something, that ought to be a conditional use. Or if we're using nitroglycerin to make a product, that's probably a conditional use. But to manufacture hot dogs or rice cakes or stethoscopes that 3M makes and things like that, that should not be a conditional use, in my humble opinion. So we continue on. On the same page of 134, back to plants and facilities. That's the major concern I have. Standards prohibiting significant adverse impacts currently applicable in CP have been made. Other notes combines current bottling plants, canning and preserving factories, carpentry cabinet and pattern shops, flour mills, feed mills, grain elevators, processing ice plants, and chemical laboratories, added as C in MC. I would ask what the interpretation of the $50+ million investment of Northwestern Radiological Isotopes might be in that respect. That combines teams with the largest research reactor in North America and will produce a medical radioactive isotope that's used by over 50,000 people a day in the United States, and is will be the only source in North America for that. I urge you to really make sure that these are permitted use as opposed to a conditional use. A whole lot of jobs and tremendous economic development is dependent upon that, in my opinion, and I have all this information for all the members of the commission. If you want, I would suggest you probably have all the information that you've ever wanted to see in your life already. That's it. Thank you.
Commissioners, questions for the speaker? Mr. McMahon.
Again, just a point of information, and we went over many of the businesses that you mentioned, business by business, business. And I think Mr. Zinner can maybe flesh this out a little more and maybe put some minds at rest. 3M, Quaker Oats, they're fine. They're permitted use. Is their primary, what's the appropriate word here? Their primary
business function.
Their primary business function is not making dynamite or something like that. Now, as far as the radioisotope sales, is that on campus?
No, it would be Discovery Ridge. It's actually on a university property, but I would just tell you that I would. Well,
and as
I understand that's completely.
We can't do anything about that.
I clearly understand that, but I will tell you that that's going to be a whole new sub industry in our community. Firmly believe that. And all those facilities will not be located in Discovery Ridge.
I think we went through a primary use test. Isn't that what we did on business by business? To make sure things weren't conditional, but were indeed permitted uses?
At least as I read the documents, it's just not very clear. And maybe it is, and that's really why I'm here, because I'm really concerned about that. But.
And I don't mean to take up much of your time, but
no,
just to clarify, because this concern has been brought up, because there have been other property owners who were concerned that what they were doing would become conditional rather than permitted, and this would perhaps in some way infringe upon their rights. In general, we didn't come up with too many instances. And that's impossible to answer with every thing, and I don't understand. I don't know the.
I'm talking about what I would consider. I would consider the companies that I mentioned to be "quote unquote" heavy industrial manufacturers, and if that is the case, then as everything I've seen in here makes that a conditional use. Plants and facilities is an extremely broad term.
Maybe Mr. Zinner can speak to this.
We can probably resolve this matter by the fact that Ms. Russell will be making an amendment to the definitions of both heavy and light industrial to provide the clarity that is needed as it relates to what constitutes a heavy industrial use and what constitutes a light industrial use, and that will be based upon the amount of that business activity that is being conducted within a wholly enclosed structure, which will then put to rest the concern as it relates to 3M and anyone else, because 90% of their business operation is within a structure.
There's
an amendment pending. We will make that amendment later this evening to address, as Mr. McMahon has pointed out, the concern that's been raised by others, and we do not disagree, Mr. Griggs. I think the definitions are slightly unclear. I have received the call from Reddy as relates to what happens in the new code. I paused greatly and then ran to my boss and said, I think we have a problem. So we are trying to make sure that we don't definitely dissuade industrial businesses coming.
Excellent.
So we'll address that this evening. I think that hopefully the way we're going to handle this will make everybody satisfied.
That's the intent and full purpose of my presence. I want to thank you all for your time, essence, and gazillions of hours of work on this project. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Griggs.
Mr. Chairman, before an additional speaker comes up, I'd like to respond to both Ms. Essing and Mr. Land's question as it relates to the parking setback.
Yes, Mr. Zinner,
as I have feverishly looked through the errata sheet as well as looked through the code to find out if we had amended the front setback. And it may be that we have covered this issue so many times, or we have been in session for such a long time, that you start to think things exist that don't. It is not addressed within the errata sheet as it relates to a modification of the parking setback line at all. The code is very clear that the parking setback line is 24 feet. It is absolute from ground through maximum building height as it relates to buildings that are on 9th or Broadway. The 24-foot parking setback line on any other street only applies to the ground floor then in any other area in the MDT. The parking setback line becomes the required building line at the second floor and above on any other street other than 9th and Broadway. The issue being you can have a parking area on your ground floor as long as it is behind a building. That is what the intent of the code was, off of an alley behind a building, but not forward of 24 feet from the adjacent property line. What I believe Ms. Essing and Mr. Land are asking you to do is to reduce that parking setback line from anywhere between 4 to 6 feet. We have allowed landscaping to be added as a option to building a street wall. And that landscape buffer, as would be defined in the errata sheet, and it would be inserted in page 187, basically is to address the issue, and it cross-references the landscape buffer strip that we refer to where we separate parking areas outside of the MDT from the adjacent road right-of-way. So the option exists for the commission should you decide as you deliberate this evening to potentially eliminate the 24-foot setback, which is derived out of the idea that we wanted a usable bay of commercial development or some development between the street and a vehicle use area. If you choose to eliminate that, that is one option is you could reduce the setback. And basically the provisions for landscape treatment would need to be consistent with what you have for what the street wall would require. Or you leave the existing 24-foot parking setback as it is, and that is basically what it's required to be. Your parking lot cannot be pulled forward of the parking setback line. There is no provision that I am looking at, and unless, Mr. Teddy, you recall making one, I don't see it here.
Yeah, the idea is that if there's going to be anything between 24 feet and 6 feet of the front lot line, that there would be solid screening. That would be one of those occasions where a street wall would be required. And then I believe the commission's opinion that doesn't necessarily have to be hardscape. It could be a landscape barrier.
That we did add.
Yeah.
Yes, that will be added. That is part of the errata sheet to allow for the softscape to be put in the place of the hardscape. I know we did discuss within work session the potential to allow perimeter treatment, similar to what we have seen for our other parking areas where we have Bank of America, you have Boone County parking lot, the one for Landmark Bank directly across from us, to potentially exist with street with landscape treatment between it and the parking area. However, that has not made it into this code. So if you desire to do that, that would require an amendment to reduce it to no less than 6 feet. And the reason I use the 6 feet is because we have a landscape buffer strip standard already in the code, which could be applied in those instances. Well, that is a decision of your own, and just for clarification for Mr. Land and Ms. Essing's questions, I offer that.
Thank you, Mr. Zinner. Any additional speakers?
My name is John Ott, and I reside at 212 Bingham, and I'm a property owner downtown. I appreciate the clarification on, I guess it's 29-4-2 on the 100 feet, less than 100 feet. There are no requirements for the fenestration, if I'm using this, if I'm saying this correctly. And I appreciate the open space flexibility, if that is in the code. And so, you know, it appears that there is opportunities to do mixed-use projects, smaller scale ones, and have, do it with creativity. The only question I have, and it's a question I don't know the answer to, but when I look at a project, and I've used this before, like Harold's Donuts, where they put it's mixed use and they have a few apartments, maybe fewer than 15, I don't know if it's bedrooms or apartments, but it's a small scale, and they don't have parking on their property. Would you be required on a project like that to put parking in? And if that is the case, would you consider not requiring that with projects that size? Because I think those are the kinds of projects we would want to encourage. And I do think that if there are parking requirements on projects those sizes, it might prevent those kinds of projects from being built because of the amount of space it would take up and then I have one other question, and that is on a case studies help me, but on a project like Cafe Berlin, where currently the building is oriented to the corner, and if, let's say, for example, down the road we want to add on to that, if the property line is less than 100 feet, and I don't know if it is, or even which direction you would take the 100 feet, how would that work? Would you be able to, with the fenestration or the codes, would you still have to build that in addition out to the street line, or could you add on to that on the same building line that, you know, which I would think would be more attractive than, but does anybody have the answer to that?
Yeah, we did put amending language in there to anticipate that situation. In fact, I used that as an example that if, since it doesn't conform to what will become present MDT, we would not require an addition to move to the required building line just for the sake of consistency with the regs. So it could be treated as a building that can expand, and because it was built legally under a different code, wouldn't have to.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. But again, I just want to, it seems like a lot of the things have been covered, but do want to, would again ask you to consider about an exemption on small mixed use buildings in regards to the parking. So thank you.
Commissioners, questions for the speaker. Mr. McMahon.
Rob, I had a, I want you to put your developer's hat on here for a minute. Let's go back to Harold's for a minute. We've got, I don't know, a dozen units in there. We've got Harold's downtown or in the first floor. Do you think it's burdensome to meet the parking requirement by some satellite parking?
You know, for some developers it might be. For example, when you the gentleman that did that project, that's his only project. That's one that he worked on. You mentioned the insurance agent. You know, some people that you know, they're property owners and they want to develop their property, but they really don't have other, you know, available property in the district or nearby, and so I mean, and I, you know, I do think that it might be a burden for, and I really don't think for those size properties it's necessary. I think, you know, we ought to encourage those kinds of projects, and if we have that requirement, it may prevent some from doing it. I, you know, with the larger scale projects, I understand, and you know, when they have a bigger footprint and so on, you can have a way to access a parking area within the property and so on, and because they usually go higher and they have bigger footprints, they can make those numbers work. But for the Harold's Donut guy, I don't think it would. It was possible on his property, and I do think it would have burden would have been a burden for him otherwise.
That's the point I was getting at. If he'd put parking on the first floor or something, you know, that's not economically viable, and that's why I was wondering about. That's why I asked you to put your developer hat on, Minifert. Say that's four or five spaces that they have to contract up somewhere. I don't know what the rates are in that building. They're pretty notable. But I'm just wondering if that shuts that building, you know, that shuts that project out if we add 3 to 4 to 5 parking places to it. Because I'm with you there. I agree with you. Those are the type of developments that I would prefer to see.
Yeah. I don't even know if, I mean, where do you find those spaces? If the land's becoming more valuable, it's hard to find someone that's going to sell you. You might be able to buy spaces in the parking garage, but I think that actually works against the prosperity of downtown Columbia, because we're using up parking spaces for residential purposes in our commercial parking garages, and it's hurting the businesses and people's use of downtown who live outside of downtown. But in many cases, and I think as time goes on, there'll be many people living down here that won't actually have cars, and that's what I think we need to encourage. And I think we'll get there, but so anyway, that's.
I just wanted to get your input because I know you've done all these small mixed use things and things are changing. Just want to get your input there.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very
much.
Thank
you,
commissioners. Mr. Rod, I have a question for you. You referenced the, and not that I disagree with you because I agree with a lot of what you said, but you don't believe that those 3 to 4 cars should be parked in a commercial parking garage. And you don't believe that it should be provided on the parcel that they're living on. Where do they park?
Well,
that doesn't take away from the business.
Yeah, I don't know how appropriate it is to discern between students and then people who maybe get in their cars and they drive away. But the problem, I think, with the in regards to the parking garages is you get people parking cars there. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and then it becomes So I have, let's say, the Berry Building, repurposed the warehouse. And those folks have parking passes, but they get in their cars and they go somewhere else during the day. So it frees up parking spaces. But the ones that are a problem are the people that don't use their cars and they sit there and they take up space. And I think a lot of the smaller, if the larger buildings will probably always be student housing, because if you have to live with students, then probably it's all going to be students. You're not going to want to share your space with students. However, the smaller ones, in many cases, and what I've found in my buildings, that you'll find, people who aren't students who are moving their cars and freeing up spaces, which I think is how it should work or can work better. So,
thank you. I was just curious. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, thank you.
Jim Meyer, 104 C Eagle Drive. I'll refrain from making a speech this evening. I do want to echo the comments that the representative from Mike Thompson's made. I'm concerned very much about the increased cost of lots and therefore new housing based on those subdivision standards. I'd also like to echo Mr. Farnan's comments about neighborhood protection. I think some of the ideas that he mentioned that you've considered and not adopted should be reconsidered. But to go back to the subdivision standards for a moment, section 29-4.5 on page 262, I can give you the entire citation, but I think you can find it in the lower middle of that page. There's the discussion about trees in the stream buffer not counting towards the 25% climax forest preservation. And when we had this discussion in that segment, the rationale for that I recalled was just that city staff thought that more trees were better and developers were getting a break by double counting. But I don't think that's a very rigorous cost-benefit analysis. And I think if you actually looked at a subdivision developed under a rule set where the stream buffer can count towards the 25 versus where it doesn't, that will make a very significant difference in the number of lots on a subdivision. And therefore, the cost of that subdivision will be spread over fewer lots, raising the lot cost, thus raising the house cost. And I think that's a problem for affordable housing. I think we ought to just think very carefully about the dollar cost trade-off for those extra trees in terms of housing affordability. Thank you.
Commissioners, questions for this speaker? I see none. Thank you, Mr. Meyer.
Good evening, all. John Clark, 403 North 9th Street, attorney, CPA. I'll note both those professions are intensely property-oriented. So they're very conservative professions. They care a lot about, and certainly in law school, about property rights and these kind of things. So I'm licensed in both of those. I've practiced in both of those. So many things to say, just not enough time. I'm here to a large extent to defend what you've done in neighborhood protection and encourage you to go much further if you can. Why do I say that? What I've heard and what I've heard discussed is basically a conflict around property rights. And so the point is, but it's really whose property rights? Is it the property rights of people who are using a property to live on, to use, this kind of stuff, a use value, or is it the property rights of those who basically own property to invest and get a return, otherwise known as the highest and best use, which has dominated lots of thinking for lots of times, but actually is really quite inimical to a good neighborhoods and a good community. So there has to be some kind of balancing between those rights. What I believe is that when the council blanket zone is R3 or R2, large portions of our town back in the 50s, 60s, or early 70s, actually they created a massive imbalance between those two kind of rights. Now, they may have thought they were doing good things, but actually that's a very long time ago. And so things have played out and happened. For instance, in my neighborhood in North Central, I believe in Benton Stevens, I believe to some extent in East Campus, it was older. But West, in say the West Central area, actually, whether it was zoned R2 or R3, a predominant use that developed and had been there actually for a long time before this zoning was done, has been single family use. And so time has kind of de facto, how people made their choices, their economic choices, has kind of clouded this issue about what the council thought it was getting out of blanket zoning. But if this imbalance was created then, it was created by council action. It was not initiated by property owners, as far as I know. It was just dumped on. It may have been thought that, oh, well, we just are going to need to have more density and so forth. And maybe if all of those areas had developed all apartment houses, that would have been fine. But that isn't the way it happened. So now we have large areas where the residents, both owner-occupants and tenants, use properties primarily for their residential use, not for their investment use, how much money they can borrow on them at the bank, whether it's retirement, whatever it is. So I would basically say that the neighborhood protection provisions, which I think need to be strengthened, are too weak, but certainly the ones you put in now, are basically a modest attempt to redress this imbalance, which is way, way, I'm going to my left, way, way over here in favor of property rights.
We need you to speak to the microphone so we can record
and
it.
It needs to move them back to the center. It's not taking, first of all, under the Constitution, zoning is not a property right in the same sense as other property rights, the property to own, sell, etc. It is not considered unless you zone all uses off of a property. So this idea of this, the restrictions that are being proposed, and they are somewhat restrictive, I think are modest. I think they will be modest in their effect on the returns of the property owners who are affected. And so I think you should retain them. I should tell you that the people talk about the new subdivisions and the restrictive covenants, when those were developed, long before this, they built in the property right protections about how high you could build in the next door and all this kind of stuff into the restrictive covenants. We cannot do that in the built environment, save the central city, because they were built long, long ago, not as big subdivisions. We have a long history in this country of gradually the government trying to create a kind of set of restrictive covenants, a minimum set of standards, very much like what is desired by homeowners associations. That's the origin, for instance, the public nuisance laws to replace private nuisance actions. I encourage you to stick with the neighborhood protections, hopefully strengthen them tonight as a matter of actually redressing that balance, which is way too over in the favor of investor property owners, and move it back into the center. Thank you very much.
Mr. Commissioners, Mr. Toohey.
I've got a quick question for you. So being a lawyer and a CPA, when did you buy your property? What year?
I bought it in 1984.
Okay, so you knew your property was zoned R3 when you bought it. So you, and being an expert in those other fields, I mean, you knew this was potentially a possibility.
Actually, I didn't know then. I hadn't gone to law school then.
Oh, well, I didn't know I needed to ask that question. Those were zoned R3, and so you had the ability to go in and research what R3 zoning meant, which means that you knew there was a possibility of extra or additional uses compared to R1 properties, correct?
Yes. Actually, so the answer to your question for me is very simple. I'm an unusual person. I ended up with a CPA. I mean, it took me 26 years to get an undergraduate degree. Then I graduated high in the CPA world. I taught myself tax law. I then went back and left Williams Keepers and went to law school. I'm sorry, using me as the standard to measure whether everybody else should have been able to research, frankly, I consider offensive and a joke. And actually, what we know, for instance, think about the 1993 floods, when nobody in the real estate business who bought property ever thought the Missouri River was a threat to their property and that they were in the floodplain until the flood came up. I just don't find that to be a useful argument and so forth. Now, I must admit, if we're back in the 60s, a few years just after this, that might be. But times have changed. A whole bunch of people have made their economic decisions. As you know, in the real estate profession, they changed all kinds of standards about disclosures and so forth once everybody realized you really do have to do these. I think this is an appropriate updating and appropriate balancing of the property rights of owner occupants and tenants who use properties in the central city, which is where we're largely talking about.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Clark.
Other questions?
Additional questions, Mr. Chu? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Crawford, 1306 Old Highway 63 South. I'd like to call your attention to the section that addresses driving and parking around a building. That's for some reason in the Neighborhood Protection Standards section. The fire department letter that you got confirmed that you have to be within 150 feet of every inch of a building. With the size of most commercial buildings and many apartments, you must be able to drive all the way around the building just to even reach it, because if it's 120 feet, say, and you have a 20-foot setback, all of a sudden you can't get to the whole building without being able to drive around it. So I want you to take that in consideration. To the same point, if I lived next to a commercial building or apartment, I would rather have the screened parking lot or drive next to my house than force the developer to put the building up next to my house. Including the drive slash park restriction in the neighborhood protection standards forces a developer to put the building up next to my house. This doesn't seem like a neighborhood protection to me. Where commercial uses abut residential neighborhoods, it is typically on the edges of neighborhoods. There will always be a line between commercial and residential, always. There is one there now. Why are we trying to move it? Any questions?
Commissioners, any questions for the speaker? I see none. Thank you, Mrs. Crawford.
Thank you.
Thank you. Would anybody else like to come forward and speak? I see none. Commissioners, are we ready for consideration of a motion to close the public input portion of the UDC? Ms. Lowe.
I would move that we close the public hearing portion on the UDC.
A motion has been made by Ms. Lowe to close the public input portion of the UDC and has been seconded by Mr. McMahon. Commissioners, discussion? Did we require a vote?
There is no vote required. If you want to take one, you're more than welcome to.
So it's closed. No additional discussion needed? Okay, so the public portion of it has been closed. On the records, Mr. Zinner. I'm sorry?
Five-minute recess.
We need a five. What about a 10-minute?
That'll work.
10-minute recess. It'll take us more than five. So 10 minutes, 7:45. guys want to grab your seats? You don't have to if you don't want to.
You lose them.
She's swearing at me.
Want to discuss what happens now?
As a group?
To the public.
When I'm done, I'll give them to you.
At three?
I have one. Oh, I have three and a comment. That's it. Go, thank God. God, two problems.
So. Thank you all. I'd like to reconvene the Thursday, December 15th Planning and Zoning Commission special public hearing. Before we get started with the commissioner's discussion, I just wanted to clarify, make sure everybody understands that the process a little bit. So this, by closing the public input portion of it just a few minutes ago, that is the last opportunity for the public to speak on this with the P&Z. Now, obviously, depending on what the planning and zoning does in January 5th, let's just assume it proceeds to city council, then the city council will have a plan to address if they're going to allow public input and how that works and when and if it's more than one occasion, et cetera. But those are details that the city council will work out. So at this time, we would just ask that we receive no more further public input. Obviously, you're welcome to continue to send things to Mr. Zinner that you might like to send him. But again, it's something that we've closed at this point, and we'll just internally work through some things. So the intent is on January 5th, we're going to make a few amendments this evening, I believe, a few amendments that we've already been working on that we'll make this evening. Come back in January 5th, and then we'll have an opportunity to make a few more amendments if necessary at that time, as the commissioners will. And then our hope is to have a vote on January 5th as to what we're going to do with the UDC. And then if the vote goes, then that recommendation would be forwarded to City Council, and then you would have the opportunity to work with City Council if some of your concerns were not addressed to the extent that you were hoping for.
And if I may just add,
yes, Mr. Zinner,
if you are going to send me any public comments, please, Christmas cards are welcomed at this point.
Popcorn
but,
tins.
I don't expect to receive them either. So what we will be producing for the public in preparation for our January 5th meeting is a comprehensive updated errata sheet that will include all of the recommended revisions that have been made since the November 16th special public hearing, and that will be available for the public to be able to review. The idea behind that is that we want to ensure that the public is aware of all of the recommended revisions. That may serve as a guide for what additional comments that you may desire to make to City Council as the document is presented forward. And in the January 5th meeting, I will probably have, we will also have a terminal staff report that basically summarizes the activities that have occurred since October 20th, as well as I will have some instruction at that point as it relates to the document that will be being presented to City Council and how it will vary from the document that we have used through these public hearings, just so the public is not surprised when it does see this UDC on Council's agenda for the first time. There will be some minor modifications to it that have been requested by the Law Department, as we previously spoke, what seems to be so many months ago. And I just want to remind our public and those that attend our meetings of what those will be. So we will do a little bit of a summary in a staff report, but we will not be going over the entire code again. We believe that the process that has been undertaken here has yielded a significant amount of information, and therefore we just want to repeat that or at least summarize that back to the public. So with that, Christmas cards are welcomed, thank yous, anything that has certificates associated with it for additional travel, but that's okay. I will be more than happy to take any comments, and those comments that are received, just so the public also is aware, will be included in the staff report that will go to City Council. So if you do have comments, not too late to send them to me. We will get them to Council as part of the Council report that will also include the Planning Commission's recommendation as it relates to the entire code. So with that, I'll turn the meeting back over to the Commission so you all can work your magic with what you have heard this evening and what other amendments that you may want to make.
Thank you, Mr. Zinner. Commissioners, it's our turn now. I believe there's some prepared amendments. Mrs. Russell, would you like to start us off, please?
Well, I'd like to first start off with a comment, and I actually thought we were going to be here much later, so I wrote it down just in case I was asleep. So I'm just going to read it. I'd like to make a comment to be in the official minutes of this meeting regarding a note we received about Commerce Court and changing the designation of the use on the permitted uses table 29.3.1 from conditional to permitted. The Commission generally believes the uses on these properties will not have a negative impact. The nonconforming uses are in a legal nonconforming status. Should a new business locate there, as long as the intensity of the use doesn't change, then the new business will be fine. The Commission further recognizes that there's been a lot of comment about certain conditional uses having to go through the Planning Commission and Council approvals before being allowed, the three layers of approval, if you will. The process would only apply to new conditional uses, not those becoming conditional as a result of the new code adoption. To address this issue, the Commission believes that it's appropriate under certain circumstances that use-specific standards be created to allow for the currently proposed conditional uses to be either permitted or conditional based on the intensity of the business operation or their location. To this end, I'd like to make a recommendation that the staff be directed by City Council following the adoption of the Unified Development Code to prepare a use-specific standards for any use that was previously listed as permitted use in the current zoning ordinance, such as the maximum number of proposed conditional uses, may be allowed as either permitted or conditional use. So I just would like to have the council direct the staff to start working on a use-permitted standards document for us.
Thank you, Mrs. Russell.
And then I have some motions.
Floor, it's all yours.
Okay. On page 161, section 29.3, use specific standards. EE 1. I'd like to add an item IV. And I'd like that to read 80% of the use activity shall occur within an enclosed building, and hazardous materials are a minor component of its business activity.
Second.
A motion has been made by Mrs. Russell and seconded by Ms. Rushing. Commissioners, questions? Discussion. Mr. Zinner.
I'd just like to add context to this. The motion is fine as it has been made. The EE that Ms. Russell referred to is use-specific condition EE as it is related to light industrial uses that are within the permitted use table. This particular amendment, we believe, or I believe, will address Mr. Griggs's concern and provides further clarification to those types of businesses that may be considered processing or manufacturing operations with the 80% in an enclosed building and a limited amount of hazardous materials. So that is just the context in which this amendment is being proposed. It deals with clarifying a light industrial use and how it may be permitted in the IG zoning district.
Commissioners, additional discussion? Questions? I see none. Mrs. Burns, when you're ready.
Yes. Mr. Tuohy?
Yes.
My vote is yes. Ms. Lowe?
Yes.
Mr. Harder?
Yes.
Mr. McMahon?
Yes.
Mr. Strodeman?
Yes.
Ms. Rushing?
Yes.
Ms. Russell?
Yes.
Motion carries 8-1.
Thank you. That will be forwarded. Additional, Mrs. Russell.
Page 34. Section 29-111 under definitions. I'd like to add the following definition to light industry. After the verbiage, it's actually on page 33. It says prepared materials. So after prepared, previously prepared materials, I'd like to amend it to add sheet metal shops or, and then it'll follow with the servicing or sale. And then additionally, in that same definition, after which activities are conducted, I'd like to amend that to add at a minimum of 80% or.
Second.
Mrs. Russell has made a motion and seconded it by Mr. McMahon. Commissioners, discussion? Ms. Lowe?
Mrs. Russell, just clarification, are we deleting the word wholly within our conducted, are we changing it from
our... No, we're leaving wholly.
Can you read what the sentence would say?
Which activities are conducted wholly or at a minimum of 80%?
Commissioners, additional discussion on the motion? I see none. When you're ready, Mrs. Secretary.
Yes. Mr. Tuohy.
Yes.
My vote is yes. Ms. Lowe.
Yes.
Mr. Harder.
Yes.
Mr. McMahon.
Yes.
Mr. Strodeman.
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Rushing.
Yes.
Ms. Russell.
Yes.
Motion carries 8-0.
Thank you. Additional, Mrs. Russell?
I have one last one.
All yours.
And then I'll be done, maybe. Page 29, section 29-111, definitions. Under heavy industry, eliminate from the last sentence sheet metal shops.
Second.
A motion has been made to remove sheet metal shops and by Mrs. Russell and seconded by Mr. McMahon. Commissioners, discussion on that motion? I see none. Mrs. Burns, when you're ready.
Yes. Mr. Tuohy?
Yes.
My vote is yes. Ms. Lowe?
Yes.
Mr. Harder?
Yes.
Mr. McMahon?
Yes.
Mr. Strodeman?
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Rushing?
Yes.
Ms. Russell?
Yes.
Motion carries 8-0.
Mr. McMahon?
I have... You're done, Ms. Russell? I would...
I'm finished.
All right. I'd like to move to amend the MDT regulating map as follows. The property in reference to the block that is bordered by Broadway, Providence, Walnut, and I believe, Mr. Farnan, that's fourth on the other side. That's correct. That property is listed in the MDT regulating map as bisected by an alley running east-west that separates the properties of Mr. Hagen and Mr. Waters and a third owner. I don't know their name. I would like to move to delete that alley from the regulating map, as it is not legal and correct.
Second.
Thank you. A motion has been made and by Mr. McMahon to eliminate the alley that has been already in the past given up and is private property, and was seconded by Mrs. Russell. Discussion by the commissioners? I see none. When Mrs. Burns is ready.
Mr. Tuohy.
Yes.
My vote is yes. Ms. Lowe.
Yes.
Mr. Harder.
Yes.
Mr. McMahon.
Yes.
Mr. Strodeman.
Yes.
Ms. Rushing.
Yes.
Ms. Russell.
Yes.
Motion carries 8-0.
Thank you. Mr. McMahon.
I have two more amendments to address some concerns as expressed by staff in regards to annexation trees and agreements with the county, the university, and other entities. The first amendment, and I think we have this wording right, in reference to section 29-5.5C1XE, page 263, as follows. Revise the text reading 5 years shown in line 2 to 6 years. And delete in whole the last sentence of the section that begins with annexed property.
Would you be able to repeat that, Mr. McMahon, just because it took me a little bit of time to
get that? I'm sorry.
No, you're fine.
The first part of the of this motion would be revised text reading 5 years shown in line 2 to 6 years and delete in whole the last sentence of the section that begins with annexed property.
Second.
Did we already do this?
I thought we
That's
did.
What I thought.
Yes.
I thought
we've already done this. Just discussed it?
That's what I thought.
Discussed only.
So a motion has been made by Mr. McMahon and seconded by Ms. Rushing, correct, Ms. Rushing?
Correct.
Ms. Rushing seconded that motion. Discussion, commissioners. Ms. Lowe, you had a question about, you thought we had done it before?
Mrs. Burns and I have not had our chance to compare our notes against the errata sheet, so.
Mr. McMahon.
This is in reference to the letter sent to us by Public Works, Mr. Glasscock specifically, in addressing the annexation issues and the lookbacks.
We didn't.
We have discussed this, but to my knowledge, we have not had an amendment on this, and I'm certainly open to being corrected.
This was discussed in our work session after our public session on Monday night. So
that's my understanding.
We couldn't. I don't see how we could have made a motion.
All right,
but I have it. I wouldn't have had my notes out for the work session, and I have it marked in my notes. But it doesn't matter if we do it a second time.
No.
Well, we will make Mr. Glasscock twice as happy.
Commissioners, additional discussion on this motion that's been made and seconded? I see none. Mrs. Secretary, when you're ready.
A quick question. Who seconded this?
Ms. Rushing.
Thank you. Mr. Tuohy.
Yes.
My vote is yes. Ms. Lowe.
Yes.
Mr. Harder.
Yes.
Mr. McMahon.
Yes.
Mr. Strodeman.
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Rushing.
Yes.
Ms. Russell.
Yes.
Motion carries 8-0.
Mr. McMahon.
I have one more motion on the same topic. In regards to section 29-5.5C1XB, page 263, as follows. Add a new item, II, that reads as follows, and renumber the sections that follow accordingly. Wording is as follows. In addition to the reforestation requirements indicated in item I above, any annexed tract containing a regulated stream for which a stream buffer would have been required and no longer exists shall be reforested with native plant species at the rate of reforestation as shown below. The reforested stream buffer shall not be credited towards meeting the 25% climax forest required by item I above. Ms. Burns, did you?
No, but this is per John Glasscock, correct?
That is correct.
Thank you.
Commissioners, do you want that motion read again, or is everyone clear?
No, can you go ahead and repeat that again?
Certainly.
Mr. McMahon, please.
In regards to section 29-5.5, C1XB on page 263, add a new item II, which will read as follows, and renumber the section that follows accordingly. In addition to the reforestation requirements indicated in I above, any annexed tract containing a regulated stream for which a stream buffer would have been required and no longer exists shall be reforested with native plant species at the rate reforested as shown below. The reforested stream buffer shall not be credited towards meeting the minimum 25% climax forest required by item I above.
Could you give the numbers again? I'm having...
I think we need a point of clarification because you're telling us it's 29-5.5 on page
463. 4.5.
If it is, I've written it down incorrectly.
4.5.
That should be 4.5.
It should be. Okay. I apologize.
Can you read us the number, Mr. Zine?
It would be 29-4.5.
And the rest is correct?
C1XB. It is on page 263. And then just for the purposes of clarification for the notes that you and Ms. Burns are taking, the preceding section would have also been 29-4.5 C1XA.
That was correct.
Okay.
Thank you, and C1XB, and what is the subsection there?
It would be a new subsection 2. So you're adding, the amendment is to add a new subsection 2 and renumber all subsections accordingly.
Okay. I get it.
Commissioners, there's been a motion made. Would anybody, is there a second?
I'll second.
Ms. Burns, thank you. A motion has been made by Mr. McMahon and seconded by Mrs. Burns. Commissioners, discussion on this motion? I see none. Mrs. Burns, when you're ready.
Yes. Mr. Toohey.
Yes.
My vote is yes. Ms. Lowe.
Yes.
Mr. Harder.
Yes.
Mr. McMahon.
Yes.
Mr. Strodeman.
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Rushing.
Yes.
Ms. Russell.
Yes.
Motion carries 8-0.
Mrs. Russell.
Actually, to clean up some of the alleys that were mentioned, I'd like to amend the regulating plan to remove the alley between 6th and 7th Street north of Elm.
6th and 7th north of Elm?
Correct. I believe that was on one of the maps that Mr. Farnan showed us.
I'll second that. If I may, we received quite a bit of input that alley was vacated quite some time ago and is incorrectly on the plan.
Doesn't appear to be shown on the plan.
I know there are other errors on this particular map. No, I understand that.
Okay. So motion was made, and I heard a second?
I second it.
Second it? Okay. Commissioners, discussion?
I've got a question about that. So when you look on the county's webpage and their parcel data, it's showing what potentially might be an alley as a dotted line. Does staff know what that dotted line means? It shows basically six lots on that block with what looks like might have been an alley at one time, or does that make sense? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Dash lines generally represent former property lines that have not been eliminated through replatting of a new plat. The plats have been consolidated. I'm trying to place the comment that was made this evening as it relates to this alley between 6th and 7th north of Elm in that block. The comment that was made this evening, unless I spaced out as Mr. Fernan talked, was about the alley that is north between Providence and 4th.
That is correct, Manager Zetter. We received input from certain members of the public regarding this specific alley that Ms. Russell brought up at least twice from different sources.
Yeah, I believe
that alley does not exist.
It was in
to have it on the plan.
It was
brings it into life.
It was in some of the information that the CID provided.
On the aerial map, it's not showing an alley there.
Is this the property of where the State Museum will be being built?
I believe it is.
Ms. Lowe?
I'm in the assessor's website, and it does show the dotted lines as been identified. Yeah, so it could be that it's not been officially vacated yet.
If that is the State Museum site, which it very well may be, we can verify that for you, and if it is not an alley, we will remove it from the map. If it is an alley, it probably does need to be identified. The State Museum site actually does have a partially vacated alley on it, and then we've eliminated other, it never had active alley use on one half of it to begin with. So there's a utility easement over that area that may be in gray if it's the site that I'm thinking it is.
Mrs. Russell?
Could I change the motion to amend the regulating plan to ensure the alley is removed between 6th and 7th Street north of Elm?
Yes, you can. Mr. McMahon, are you seconding?
I think so. That makes it conditional then. Is that correct?
It makes them fix it.
Okay, that's where we're going. Okay.
We so will take care of the problem.
Pat, I think someone said fix it.
Mr. McMahon, you're good at the second still?
I am. I just want to make sure what I was seconding.
Commissioners, discussion? I see none. Mrs. Burns, when you're ready.
Yes. Mr. Toohey?
Yes.
My vote is yes. Ms. Lowe?
Yes.
Mr. Harder?
Yes.
Mr. McMahon?
Yes.
Mr. Strodeman?
Yes.
Ms. Rushing?
Yes.
Ms. Russell?
Yes.
Motion carries 8-0.
While we're dealing with the regulating plan, the CID had also sent us information with regards to a property at 24 South 9th Street where there appears to be an alley on the regulating plan. But again, if you look at the data on the assessor's webpage and the mapping data, that property at 24 South 9th Street butts up to the property behind it, which would mean that alley doesn't technically go through.
Mr. Zinner? Mr. McMahon?
Which block? You're on South 9th and the first block south of Broadway?
It's between 9th and 10th, just north of Cherry.
And those alleys go as the map you gave us earlier?
Excuse me?
In regards to referencing the map that you passed out earlier, those alleys do both go all the way through. I'm not...
Not according to the way that parcel is divided.
Physical passage.
Yeah, that parcel does go to the back.
The parcels go all the way across the...
You're talking about Alley A?
All the way across. In the middle of the alley.
It's just south of Alley. Right,
the north-south, is it the north-south segment?
It has the appearance of an alley by occupation because there's a continuous alleyway, but we believe there's a property line
that goes across.
The alley encroaches upon.
Right.
Is that fair way to say it?
The alley's there, but the lot line extends into it.
Mr. McMahon?
This is my problem. Yeah, I'm very familiar with the physical space and the layout. We have fire exits on that. And this is what kind of confuses me. Are we problematic in any way, shape, or form there?
North, south.
Like my fire exit is through your property? I mean, some of the buildings, the only egress for some of those apartments is through the back.
Talking about north or south of where that parcel appears to
here?
Be.
I would be south of Alley A.
Yeah, south of Alley A, but between Alley A and then where that parcel line is. Is that where the fire exits are that you're referring to?
Well, there are a variety of exits. There are for different uses throughout that area, and this is what...
Oh, looks like it's Lakota that goes like it's all Lakota. The way back.
The lot for Lakota
so
goes all the way back.
It's only that building parcel. The rest of them stop at the alley.
The scale I'm looking at.
I can resolve that on my own. I'm just wondering... Mr. Toohey, what was your issue there?
My issue is if it's not an alley, how can it be on the regulating plan?
There's a physical alley there, so I think that's why it was so designated. What I'd propose is that we try to resolve whether or not it's a proper
alley. I mean, it might be an alley by occupation, meaning it's been used as such.
But not a legal alley.
Right, common law.
And that's my issue. If it's not a legal alley, why would it be on the regulating plan?
Well, then we have a problem if it's not a legal alley.
We can take off that portion of it that's within private property. I think we have to do that research, unless you have something that you know about.
No.
Ms. Lowe?
If the other buildings have, I mean, if it's been identified as a public way and there are the buildings that back up to it that do have fire exits to it as a public way, even if it dead ends in the middle, I think we should leave it as a public way at this time and let the city resolve that.
I'm fairly familiar with this, as Mr. Ott could probably testify. 10, the business, the ancillary bar to Harpo's, that's their primary access and egress is off that alley. The fire exit for Lakota, a fire exit for Lakota, is off of that alley.
Or south one.
I do believe, I don't know if Mr. Ott is still here.
Mr. McInerney, and I don't think we have the wherewithal to actually answer.
Well, that's that the point question. I'm saying. Before we remove anything off, there certainly appears to be some problematic issues with what is and isn't fire exits and business entrances and such. I think maybe we should have this researched more before we take any action on the same.
Mr. Zinner, would you be able to research it and provide us information before January 5th?
Or concurrent with the January 5th meeting.
Right.
We'll have...
As part of the package?
We'll have it part of the package.
Thank you. Additional, Mr. Zinner.
I would suggest, however, as a similar motion to Ms. Russell's on the previous alley segment, please make a motion so the minutes do reflect that you have asked staff to research the removal of this particular alley segment, which would have been identified as item number 3 in the CID's letter of December 15th under MDT regulating plan amendments.
Mr. Tuohy, would you like to form a motion?
Like that?
Yes. That staff would go in and research this particular alley to verify whether or not it's a legal alley or not.
Second.
Mr. Tuohy willingly made a motion and seconded by Ms. Lowe. Commissioners, discussion on this motion. I see none. I guess we need a vote?
I guess so.
Make a vote, please, Mrs. Burns.
Yes. Mr. Tuohy.
Yes.
My vote is yes. Ms. Lowe.
Yes.
Mr. Harder.
Yes.
Mr. McMahon.
Yes.
Mr. Strodeman.
Yes.
Ms. Rushing.
Yes.
Ms. Russell.
Yes.
Motion carries 8-0.
Thank you, Mrs. Burns.
While we're on the regulating plan, I guess we'll go ahead and make another one. I make a motion that we go ahead and extend the core height area east to Hitt Street.
I'll second.
Thank you. A motion has been made by Mr. Tuohy to extend the building height, the core height max 10 stories east to Hitt Street, and seconded by Ms. Lowe. Commissioners, questions? Ms. Lowe.
Mr. Zinner, I have a follow-up question on this, because that core height limit actually appears to bisect several lots, and if we're going to make a corrective action on this one, I think we need to look at all of them. So can you explain or clarify what happens when that height limit bisects a lot?
Building would step down accordingly. I'd like to ask, if I may, as a follow-up to the motion, are you wanting the entire core height boundary moved from Broadway? Are you wanting that entire eastern boundary line running both north of Broadway and south of Broadway to be extended east to Hitt Street? So there is one consistent north-south line that follows the right-of-way, the western right-of-way of Hitt. or are you only wanting this to apply south of Broadway?
Mr. Tuohy, any clarification on your motion?
I guess I would say both north and south, so that line remains straight on the east side of town instead of having it jog at Broadway.
One concern, Mr. Tuohy, might be that on the north side of Broadway, you're starting to kind of maybe split lots, similar to the concern that was brought to your attention earlier.
And I think one solution to that is that if you want an entire lot not to be split, you may want to include the entire lot. I think what we have here is an issue. You've got lots and you've got buildings. To the north, I would say that there are possibly lot lines that could be used to extend north, if you so chose to do that. And then if we extended south, so you'd have a slightly jagged line, but based on the way that the scale of the mapping right now, that probably may not be as dramatic as it may look. And then if you did take it fully south, south of Broadway to the western line of HIT, that creates one continuous southerly segment of the line that's not impacted by individual lots. And at that point, I think that that would probably be a reasonable alternative if you want to move, if you would like to move the northern portion of it over as well.
Mr. McMahon?
Yes, thanks to Mr. Colbert, we've heard from one of the property owners who has the problem of having his building bisected. And while another major property owner along this line is the City of Columbia, there are at least one, two, three, four, there may be five, I can't remember how these lots break, other property owners that we have not heard from, nor have we heard from the individuals who own properties on the east side of HIT to see how they would feel with, rather than having a potential six-story building across the street from them on a very narrow street, a 10-story building across the street from them on a very narrow street. And while I appreciate Mr. Colbert's problems, I would suggest that the motion as offered is problematic because we haven't heard from these property owners. And a specific remedy may be to help out a specific property owner, even though it does create a jagged line. Because I've been in the building, I've leased space in the building. It's cut in half as the line is drawn right now.
Further discussion, commissioners? A motion has been made and is on the table by Mr. Tuohy and seconded by Ms. Lowe. Any additional discussion needed?
As amended, correct?
As amended to the north.
We want to bring it to the west line of HIT, extended the full length of the line. So the boundary moves east.
Commissioners? No further discussion, then we'll have a vote on this motion.
Mr. Tuohy?
Yes.
My vote is yes. Ms. Lowe?
No.
Mr. Harder?
Yes.
Mr. McMahon?
No.
Mr. Strodman?
Yes.
Ms. Rushing?
No.
Ms. Russell?
Yes.
5-3, motion carries.
And just for purposes of clarification for the minutes and so staff knows what they're doing, are we or are we not, because it was not included as part of the motion, following the lot lines to the north, or are we just extending the line straight up from the west boundary line of HIT?
So would you like another motion to clarify that?
It's entirely up to you. I'm interpreting that the motion that you have made and you have just approved is extending it straight up along the west line of HIT, which will cut buildings in half north of Broadway when you extend that boundary line. So you're potentially going to create additional issues, which is, I believe, what Mr. Strotman was trying to point out, north of Broadway. We have other existing infrastructure structures that are there that are going to be split by this 10-story core height.
Ms. Lowe?
It appears there's lot lines very close to that west boundary on HIT. Could it not follow the property line versus
That's what I'm wanting to clarify. Is that what the intent of the motion was, to follow the property lines north of Broadway and follow the west boundary line of HIT south of Broadway?
Mr. Toohey?
Can you repeat that?
Was it the intent in the motion to follow property lines north of Broadway and follow the right-of-way line, the west right-of-way line of HIT Street south of Broadway?
Yes, that was the intent of the motion.
Thank you. That's all I needed to know.
Commissioners, everyone's clear on that clarification, and the vote is still the vote. Okay. Additional discussion, commissioners? Mrs. Burns.
Yes, I wanted to revisit the amendment that we made to section 29-4.2C to revise the MDT regulating plan such that its boundary line is moved to the center line of St. James as it travels from Park to Ash, and retract the small tails that are remaining back into the intersection of St. James and Ash and St. James and Park. And I think, Mr. McMahon, you made this at a previous meeting, and we didn't have a chance to, in my mind, I didn't, it wasn't fully resolved for me. And so you had spoken with people from the neighborhood. We've never had anyone from the public come and ask for this, and we've had two tonight speak in favor of putting it back into the MDT. So could you elaborate again on why you made this motion? Or this
certainly.
Amendment?
And staff can help me here just a little bit. This was not in any of the versions of Columbia Imagine. As a matter of fact, it wasn't even the first version of the UDO. This movement was a staff action as it moved from, and it was designed, I believe, to incorporate the Ameren property. And once the Ameren property was incorporated, then the other M1 across the street in St. James was incorporated. When that was noticed by the property owners, and I'm sorry they're not here, I can't speak to why they spoke to me and didn't come in. You know, they were concerned with having, they were not aware that this was the case, and they were concerned with having that, the potential for MDT development right next to them, right in their backyards, as they put it. It had been my hope that, in making that motion, that the issues associated with the property north of Park, as I refer to it as the triangle, which we're going to do after the take up after the MDT, after the UDO, how that's going to be zoned. And there, when I say the triangle, I refer to the area Park, Rogers, and 10th. That area is currently not in the MDT, and we're going to have public hearings. A lot of things are going to develop. Mr. Colbert, Mr. Ott have spoken with us in the past about they'd like to extend the MDT up there. Mr. Eifert also has property up there. It had been my hope that when we have the discussion about that triangle, we have a similar public discussion about St. James and St. Joseph. And that's not only because of that area right there. It's also because this body and council have taken a variety of steps to protect the Hubble Street. And we're essentially surrounding it, or potentially surrounding it, without a public hearing process, without a public process, which will allow property owners, which will allow homeowners to come in and say what they think, rather than administratively moving that boundary. Because like I said, in Columbia Imagine, it was not there. And in the earliest versions of the UDO, it was not present. But it was when it was moved, someone brought it to my attention, hey, this has been moved. And that's when I looked, noticed it was looked, and the property owners came to me and said, I don't know about this.
And I appreciate that. Thank you. I guess since the property owners didn't come to us, that's a concern for me. And the fact that this is part of the downtown CID and includes tenants such as Dogmaster Distillery, Yoga Soul, and Talking Horse Theater, and to be consistent that the location should be included within the MDT. So I guess I am making a motion to remove this amendment and place this area back into the MDT.
I'll second that.
A motion has been made to extend the MDT boundaries by Mrs. Burns and seconded by Mr. Toohey. Commissioners, discussion?
That's just to the east, right?
It's from east. Park, it's to the
across
south.
Across the street, just across the street.
Right.
Okay.
So to clarify, Mrs. Burns, that would be restoring
the original proposal.
What I have on the old map?
Well, what our motion was to revise the MDT regulating plan such that its boundary line is moved back to the center line of St. James as it travels from Park to Ash.
That's your motion?
No, that's the motion.
That was my motion. Oh, okay. That was my amendment.
I'm asking us to rescind.
I was going to say.
No.
Okay.
Got it. So it would go back to
we're putting it back to the other side. Okay.
Which on my map is, if no one else has theirs, is the backside of the properties on the east side of St. James.
And the entire block would be?
Well, from Park to
it's
the
done.
Ash.
It's done on frontage, I believe. So the ones that front along St. James.
Yes, the businesses that I mentioned.
Yeah, so you don't have to carry it into the lot, but second.
I think Mr. Toohey had seconded.
Okay. So never mind.
Thank you, though.
Third. But you have a vote.
Any additional discussion, commissioners? I see none. Mrs. Burns, when you're ready.
Yes. Mr. Toohey?
Yes.
My vote is yes. Ms. Lowe?
Yes.
Mr. Harder?
Yes.
Mr. McMahon?
No.
Mr. Strodman?
Yes.
Ms. Rushing?
Yes.
Ms. Russell?
Yes.
Motion carries 7-1.
Thank you, Mrs. Burns. Ms. Lowe?
On page 188, item 29-4.2, B8, balconies, I just wanted to clarify that the building code is not setting the maximum of balconies since we've now adopted a more restrictive depth in the zoning code. So in item IIIC, delete maximum projection and minimum height above public sidewalk shall be governed by and replace it with the proposed balcony meets all the applicable requirements of. So it would read the proposed balcony meets all the applicable requirements of the building code of Columbia, Missouri, adopted in Chapter 6 of the City Code.
But when we discuss this, that would increase the amount it could encroach to four.
The discussion is when more than one provision applies, the most restrictive provision shall govern.
And the 2 feet that we have in here would be the most restrictive.
Correct.
So if you have only the building code apply, then it would be 4 feet.
This is not saying only the building code.
Yeah, it is. If you take out, you would say the applicable provisions of the building code shall apply.
That does not the following item says the proposed balcony meets all the applicable design standards contained in this code and other ordinances passed by the council.
I thought we had amended C to say, and this could be another place where we just talked about it, the minimum height above the public sidewalk shall be governed by the building code of Columbia, Missouri. So then if it's amended in that respect, then you're making it clear, or you're trying to make it clearer that this governs balconies and not the building code.
The building code governs more than height above sidewalks, so we did not pass that, and I don't think we should restrict it just to that in this ordinance. By stating that only the applicable requirements contained in the code that it meets those, it's simply pointing anyone who's doing balconies to the fact that additional provisions are contained in the building code and they need to double check those. I'm merely trying to eliminate the language that says the maximum overhang is identified in the building code because this code is also identifying a more restrictive overhang. I'm open to other language, but I don't think it's fair to restrict it only to the height above sidewalks.
Again, I just indicated in my notes I thought that we had made that change based on staff's recommendation.
We discussed it on Monday,
discussed it.
But we have okay. not.
Okie doke.
Mr. Zinner?
I guess in the context of what this provision is trying to achieve, we're not limiting the building code from any other application as it relates to any other type of development. We're basically limiting the building code's application as it relates to balconies specifically. So if you take out maximum projection, which we do have a more restrictive standard, and you're not saying default to the building code for your maximum projection, you're referring to the building code for the minimum height, which is also addressed elsewhere within the city code as part of Chapter 24. So, I mean, the building code will be trumped by any other code standard that we have, which is the reason for item D, that it has to meet any other city code. And, you know, the building code is part of the city code. It's adopted as part of the city code, and I would suggest to you, if you don't want to have any conflict, just delete C.
I find the language confusing, saying this code is setting standards and the minimum and maximum are established in another code.
Well, what I would tell you then is if that's the concern and the commission has a tendency to, if they agree, if you eliminate C, D basically says that the proposed balcony meets all applicable design standards contained in this code, which would mean that it can't project more than 2 feet,
mm-hmm.
and it meets all other ordinances passed by city by the council.
Which includes the building
which
code.
Which includes the building code. You're covered.
But can we eliminate item C?
I would suggest go right ahead and do it.
I like that one. So I will withdraw the motion, which was not seconded, so I'm not sure I need to. And I'll make a new motion to delete item 29-4.2D8IIIC.
Second.
Mrs. Russell? Good second. A motion has been made by Ms. Lowe and to eliminate Section C, and seconded by Mrs. Russell. Discussion, commissioners? I see none. Mrs. Burns, when you're ready.
Mr. Toohey?
Yes.
My vote is yes. Ms. Lowe?
Yes.
Mr. Harder?
Yes.
Mr. McMahon?
Yes.
Mr. Strodeman?
Yes.
Ms. Rushing?
Yes.
Ms. Russell?
Yes.
Motion carries 8-0.
Thank you, Mrs. Burns. Ms. Lowe.
The previous page, 187, covers parking lot setback lines. And this has been brought up tonight, and I would like to have a discussion on it. So we received a letter from CID proposing the setback line be revised from 24 feet to 4 to 6 feet.
Are you talking Section 9, Part B?
29-4.2DIX, the whole of IX. So, but B specifically, yeah, more particular.
I would support reducing that to, I think the term the staff used was no less than 6 feet.
Does staff have any comment on this?
I mean, I think we have to be careful as to what we unintentionally create as it relates to a building that may be torn down with not an intention of rebuilding a building, but allowing a parking lot, a surface parking lot, to be installed, which is no longer a conditional use within the downtown district. So the MDT will allow you to build a parking lot by right, provided that you meet the MDT standards, which means right now you're required to basically set that parking lot back 24 feet from a right-of-way, especially if it's a freestanding use, and you're required at that point to build a street wall, which you have amended to allow to be a soft street wall, but that soft street wall would be at 24 feet. So if you look at it in that instance, it may seem somewhat counterintuitive to the fact that we're trying to create a streetscape or a street wall that's equivalent maybe to your adjacent built structures that are going to be probably built directly to the property line. So there may not be a forecourt, there may not be any space between the building facade wall and the sidewalk. A 24-foot setback is going to look maybe odd in that situation, whereas moving it forward to a minimum of maybe a 6-foot space, which I believe is what Mr. Toohey is suggesting, and requiring that that be either soft landscaped or hard landscaped as defined within the street wall provisions may not be objectionable in some instances. However, it could be in others. And ultimately, what Farrell Madden wanted to do is they wanted to create a walkable environment. Parking lots and then parking lots that may have to have driveway accesses to get into them will not promote a walkable downtown when they are directly or in close proximity possibly to the right-of-way. That's my observation. I mean, the decision is yours. I think when a undeveloped parcel, when there is no other development other than a parking lot being permitted on or being proposed on that lot, I think if you move it, you incentivize that parking lot to remain there in perpetuity. Now, granted, we have land value probably downtown that it's going to be very rare that you're going to see somebody leave a permanent parking lot there. We do have, in some instances, a pronounced parking problem where it may be more economical to tear a building down and build a parking lot. And that is that may be contrary to the parking utility's objective of trying to not have private competitive parking that's surface parking that's market rate. You build a parking lot to support a land use, i.e. a building. You don't build a parking lot to compete competitively, or you should not, I believe, build a parking lot to compete competitively with the city unless you have a building that goes along with it. Because you can always lease a parking lot if you have a building to somebody other than your tenants. I mean, that's hence why the reason that the code changed by allowing a parking lot then to be a permissible use, but a permissible use with a building behind the parking setback line. It wasn't to allow surface parking lots all of a sudden to be reintroduced into downtown without any additional design requirements or disincentive. So you remove the 24-foot parking setback line, you remove a disincentive for people to tear buildings down and don't build a building back and lease that space, which would definitely not be, I think, going in the appropriate direction.
If I may just add what Mr. Zinner told you, we did add a couple of exceptions from the 24-foot parking setback rule. One is for the presence of a utility easement, which is rare downtown, but there are at least a couple examples where utility easement is where the required building line would be. In that case, the parking is going to be allowed over an easement, but a building is not. So code recognizes now that hardship situation would allow parking within the 24 foot. And then another exception would be if screened, solid screening that was already mentioned. There be understood there'd be no more than 60 feet total width along the street, because the idea is you don't want to gut your streetscape, and then there'd also be no driveways directly accessing that from the street. So it'd be rear accessed or maybe side accessed parking.
Mr. Zinner. Mr. Teddy. Any additional? Hello.
Mr. Teddy, just to clarify, I'm looking at item B, and it says a parking area of not greater than 60 feet in width may be permitted closer if screened. Yeah. So is it's only parking lots less than 60 feet in width if screened.
Yeah, the idea, again, is so blocks aren't dominated by parking lots. That's, I think, why the conditional use provision was put in a number of years ago, was that there were surface parking lots being built in front yards, spaces, and it was really changing or threatening to change the character of the downtown.
Ms. Lowe?
Mr. Zenner, I believe the commission is concerned about maintaining or creating a pedestrian zone. Is there a minimum width for a planting area that's suggested or recommended for maintaining a viable landscaped area?
And I think, given, and I apologize, the content sometimes gets away from us here. So with what Mr. Teddy just read, there was a reason I don't recall it is because I didn't add it. The provision that Mr. Teddy read, and it's B, a big B and then little b within the paragraph, as long as you're not more than 60 feet in width, you could pull that parking area forward. You could have a parking area. It doesn't specify how close. So, yes, the space, and we have a defined buffer width right now, a minimum landscape buffer of 6 feet. It applies. And in that particular instance, I would probably tell you that the minimum buffer width, so you could not pull a parking area closer than 6 feet to the property line, which would basically reduce your 24 minus 6 is, what, 18? You'd basically take an 18-foot reduction in the setback line, provided you screened, you did a street wall. Now, the way that this reads, it does not offer a landscaping option in that provision. However, item 11 on the same page does. That's where we have added the landscape screen. So there can be a combination of a solid wall landscaping screen. It could be a landscape screen that meets the minimum landscape buffer requirement, which is what we use for any other parking lot. So at that point, if you want to specify in big B, little b within this section that the parking area cannot come forward more, it cannot be within 6 feet of the property line, that is probably the clarification that's needed in order to address what the CID comment has been made and what Mr. Land has presented tonight as well. So that would reduce, it would give an 18-foot reduction. I would strongly suggest that 18-foot reduction not be permitted on 9th or on Broadway, and that the 24-foot setback be required to be maintained on both of those streets, given the characteristic activity that is there of retail use. Couple that with the fact that the majority of what is already in existence, it's the built environment, and we don't want to encourage probably buildings to be torn down to be replaced with parking lots by reducing the front parking setback in those locations specifically. However, anywhere else downtown, I think, is fair game if that's how you would like to approach this.
Hello?
I had a question about minimum width for landscaping.
6 feet.
That will keep a viable landscape
pedestrian
area.
Environment.
Yes. You know,
yeah, okay. And it will actually, that particular width is what's defined as being the minimal area for a viable living screen.
Mr. Zenner, your comments were addressed at big B, little b. But I think we're also looking back at IX, where they have the generally 24 feet behind the property.
And the way, so if
what, what would the difference be if we changed that to 6 feet versus big B, little b? No, cannot be within 6 feet of the sidewalk. Big B, little b, that 60 feet in width seems pretty restrictive.
If
our commissioners have an errata sheet in front of them, and again, I apologize, I do not. If one can find under the MDT revisions specifically that were made, if one can look up for me, because I believe we've referenced the 6 feet in the amendment to item 11. I believe I have added, there was added text. I saw it earlier this evening when I was looking at my version of it online. We have added it in that particular area. I just want to make sure that the cross-reference notation to 29-4.5E is there, because that is what defines the 6 foot minimum. If it is, I understand your point, Ms. Lowe. The standards in on page 187 that we were requiring that the landscape buffer be added, it will read, and this is what is referred to on page 187 of the code, item number I or XI, so it would be Roman numeral 11. The text is being proposed to be revised per a previous amendment. Street walls may be constructed either constructed utilizing either masonry, ornamental materials, or a private landscape buffer in accordance with the provisions of 29-4.5D1 or any combination thereof. Walls may be opaque or partially open and may include landscaping. So the idea here with that revision was to emulate or replicate the type of parking lot separation that we have at the Bank of America building that we have over here at Landmark. So that would fulfill that. So going back to Ms. Lowe's principal question then, item number 9 on the same page could be reduced or could be revised to take if you wanted to create in the beginning paragraph of item number 9 and the 24 feet, because it applies to A, that's why it's stated the way that it's stated, because A is basically saying that you have to comply with the 24-foot setback on Broadway and 9th.
And 9 is actually for the floors above the first floor. So we are looking at B, but not B little b necessarily.
So parking.
Looking at the 24
feet. Yes, so B would be, if you revise the first line in B, that parking shall not be located closer than, and 24 would be amended to 6 feet to the required building line on any first floor level with the following exceptions. And then little b does not need to be amended, because little b is going to allow you, you are going to be required to have a street wall. The street wall requirement is in item number 11, Roman numeral 11. And it gives you that specification. And basically, b, after you revise 24 feet to 6 feet, it allows parking to be actually added or on the second story and above directly to the RBL. So in essence, if you did a shop space on the ground floor, you have an option at this point. If you wanted to do underground parking or first floor ground parking, you still are not going to be able to have that parking directly at the required building line at the first floor on any other street other than 9th or any other street other than 9th and Broadway. It basically limits the usability of the ground floor space as a viable retail shop space, because of the depth will be reduced so significantly.
But if it, this could have addressed possibly the issue associated with the Harold's Donut shop building, to where you may have been able to accommodate tuck-under parking in the building forward of the 24-foot setback line, or the parking line as it exists today, to accommodate that parking on site, if it didn't completely diminish the viability of your construction project and you didn't choose another option, such as leasing parking spaces from the city or finding another parking contract area within a quarter of a mile of your building site. I would suggest if you're trying to resolve the matter as has been presented this evening by the CID and requested by Mr. Land, revise the item number 9B by striking 24 feet and revising that to no closer than 6 feet to the required building line. All other standards that have been revised then will afford us the opportunity to ensure a street wall is provided.
Mm-hmm. I'll make that motion.
Ms. Lowe.
29-4.2D9B, strike 24 feet and revise it to no closer than 6 feet to the required building line.
Second.
A motion has been made by Ms. Lowe to change the 24-foot required building line to 6 foot, no closer than 6 foot, and seconded by Ms. Rushing. Discussion, commissioners? Questions? I see none. When you're ready, Mrs. Burns?
Yes. Mr. Toohey?
Yes.
My vote is yes. Ms. Lowe?
Yes.
Mr. Harder?
Yes.
Mr. McMahon?
No.
Mr. Strodman?
Yes.
Ms. Rushing?
Yes.
Ms. Russell?
Yes.
Motion carries 7-1.
Thank you, Mrs. Burns. Additional items, commissioners?
I'll go ahead and make a motion.
Mr. Toohey?
I make a motion that we strike section 29-4.8 neighborhood protection standards with the intent that we bring those back in January and come up with some ideas that will help provide a remedy to both neighbors or both all property owners affected by those neighborhood protection changes.
Commissioners, a motion has been made. Will there be a second?
I'll second it.
A motion has been made to strike. what was the section number again, Mr. Toohey? Sorry.
29-4.8.
It was made by Mr. Toohey and seconded by Mr. Harder. Commissioners, discussions? Mr. McMahon.
You'd like to strike neighborhood protections to a later date. Is that, I'm not following that.
Yes. I would just like to allow us more time. I mean, I understand people want to move forward with the UDO. I understand that. But I feel like if we could have some more time to discuss this section and then send it forward.
And I need to say that I have made votes on items during our discussion based on the fact that there were neighborhood protections. And if those are stricken, then I may need to revisit some of my votes.
Mrs. Burns?
I don't agree with striking that section. I understand that there is not a win-win situation, and there's never going to be a win-win situation. But to strike the entire thing to a later date, to me, does not serve the people that have come here and discussed it. We need to move it forward and have council continue to discuss it and continue to refine it.
McMahon?
This section, along with all other sections, are amendable. And even if it passes council as it is, I think the political process will continue on a variety of fronts, including this one. And I see them as a net plus. The neighborhood protections, that is.
Additional discussion? Ms. Lowe.
I'm not sure I could comfortably approve this segment without something in place, so I don't think I can support removing it at this time.
Mrs. Russell?
I'm not sure striking it really accomplishes anything. I think we can come back and do some amendments on the 5th if we can find a win-win. I'm not sure where that win-win is with this neighborhood protection. It feels like we're stuck in the middle of a war. And so I don't see what striking the whole section does. So
I just feel like it gives us some more time if we need to extend the conversation a few more weeks or to a few more meetings.
We have more time, even if we leave it in place, to come back and propose amendments.
Mr. McMahon?
On that very topic, we have issues that stand unresolved. Historical preservation, the zoning, northeast of the MDT. There are a variety of issues that are still to be addressed in the future. Be that as it may, I find the neighborhood protections very minimal, very doable. They leave profit in, and they provide some protection for the individuals in the neighborhoods. To strike them sends a very unfortunate message to the 20,000 or so people who live downtown
and
throughout the city, because we've had this issue downtown. We have the RMF issue, and I'll finish in just a second. We just had a case. We had three cases last time where the neighborhood protections the neighbors wanted. They didn't want through streets. That's what they didn't want. So neighborhood protections is an ongoing issue that we'll continue to have to parse out, and I don't think setting it aside serves anyone. I think having something in place and moving forward, perhaps a piece at a time, is a better way to go.
And I understand the intent of having them. I think that there do need to be some sort of neighborhood protections, but every time we've tried to come up with a remedy during our work sessions, we can't come up with one. And so that's why I'm making this motion, so that if we do strike it, it would allow us more time to still process what that remedy would be for the property owners who feel like they're losing value in their properties because they're not going to be able to potentially do with their property what their intent was when they purchased it.
And then if we don't come up with anything, there's nothing.
I think all of our intents, though, was very clear to have some type of neighborhood protection.
Mr. Zinner?
Then let's leave this in place until.
Mr. Zinner?
If I may just provide a little bit maybe of perspective here, I mean, you can make a motion is on the floor to eliminate the entire section. However, I believe what Mr. Toohey just said is there was an understanding that something was going to be moved forward, and I get the sense that the commission as a whole, while acknowledging that this section has challenges associated with it, does need to have some additional review. The motion maybe, if your pending motion fails, is to, as part of your motion for the entire UDC to council, is to acknowledge or state specifically within that motion that this particular segment or this particular section of the code has proven extremely challenging and troublesome as it relates to the conflicting values of the opposing groups, and that it may warrant additional review, and that the commission would welcome the opportunity to do so. Council could choose to suspend the application of this particular section in their venue.
As they deliberate on it, they could approve it as it is written with specific remand back to the commission, as they do often with other text amendments, to work on it to address those competing issues. I think if the commission does not feel it appropriate to delete the entire section at this point, I think the point that Mr. Toohey is making can be conveyed to the council, possibly just by observations such as Ms. Russell's motion today to deal with the conditional uses on the Commerce Court area and conditional uses in general within the code, seeking council to redirect this particular segment back to you for additional review. That may be a middle point for you all if you do generally agree that this section needs more work and we need to see if we can't come to that common ground short of deleting it in whole.
Thank you, Mr. Zinner. Commissioners, any additional discussion needed? I see none. Mrs. Burns, when you're ready.
Yes. Mr. Toohey.
Yes.
My vote is no. Ms. Lowe.
No.
Mr. Harder.
Yes.
Mr. McMahon.
No.
Mr. Strodman.
No.
Ms. Rushing.
No.
Ms. Russell?
No.
Motion is fails 7-2.
Thank you, Mrs. Burns. Commissioners, additional motion? Ms. Lowe.
We received communication with some concern about the definition for group homes, and I don't believe we've modified that definition yet. I'd like to make an amendment to the definition. It's page 28. Item 29-1.11, definitions, page 28, definition of group home, small, add the sentence, residents with up to three unrelated residents are not defined as a group home.
So for clarification, Ms. Lowe, is that in the group home large, group home small?
Group home small.
Small, okay, thank you.
Adding a sentence.
Mr. Zinner, do you have
end of the definition?
At the end of the definition, per our discussion previously in work session.
Mr. McMahon?
Do you have a second?
No.
I do not have a second.
Yeah, you've got one now.
So a motion has been made by Ms. Lowe and seconded by Mr. McMahon. Commissioners, discussion?
Can you repeat it one more time?
Move to modify the definition of group home small at 29-1.11 definitions. Add a sentence, residents with up to three unrelated residents, with a T, are not defined as a group home. And just commentary on that is just clarifying it already meets the definition of family in our code.
Mr. McMahon?
Just to follow up on that, that resolves half the issue as it was presented to us. We still have the 4-8 issue to address. Is that correct? No?
No.
All right.
I think this addressed that.
This addresses all that. Yeah. Okay.
The other issue had to deal with the distance.
Distance, 1,000 feet. Commissioners, additional discussion? I see none. Mrs. Burns, when you're ready.
Mr. Toohey.
Yes.
My vote is yes. Ms. Lowe.
Yes.
Mr. Harder.
Yes.
Mr. McMahon.
Yes.
Mr. Strodman.
Yes.
Ms. Rushing.
Yes.
Ms. Russell.
Yes.
Motion carries 8-1.
Thank you, Mrs. Secretary.
I'm sorry, 8-0.
Thank you, Mrs. Secretary. Mrs. Russell.
So, Mr. Zinner, do we need to make a motion to get to ask council to return neighborhood protection to us, or do we just need to make that a comment in the minutes like we did?
I would say make it a comment in the minutes. It'll be in the report, and I think as we summarize the commission's deliberation, that will become a primary topic as it relates to the deliberation and the challenges that you all encountered at arriving at a final recommendation. It has been a very prominent feature of our discussions, of our hearings, and those are the types of things that we would identify for council so they're aware of them.
So I'd like to make a comment for the minutes that neighborhood protection standards continues to be a stumbling block for the commission, and we would like the council to return it to us for further deliberation.
Thank you, Mrs. Russell. Ms. Lowe.
We also received a letter from the Historic Preservation Group about expanding the urban storefront area, and I wanted to acknowledge that letter since we'd also received commentary from DLC on the same matter. We did discuss this in work session, and the consensus of the commission was that the change proposed was a large change, and we simply didn't have the adequate opportunity to vet it or to have the public vet that change. So it's something that, again, could be looked at in the future. And anyone's free to add comment to that, but I just wanted to acknowledge that we had received that and we did review it.
Mrs. Burns.
It was my understanding that there was going to be a representative from Historic Preservation tonight, but no one came forward. So, again, that didn't allow us to continue that discussion in a public fashion.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
You received correspondence from Jay Linder, and I believe this was raised in work session before this evening's meeting, and maybe Mr. Toohey would like to make reference to that letter that we had received regarding a request to give consideration to use-specific standard AA, which refers to retail in general. Not sure if, Mr. Toohey, you would like to address that matter as you had asked in work session, or if you would like me to just present what Mr. Linder has provided to you all so the public has an opportunity and that's at least acknowledged in the record.
I'm fine with you going ahead and presenting that, Mr. Center.
Jay Linder with the Forum Development Group provided us this evening a letter as it relates to retail use size limitations, which is use-specific condition AA. And several concerns and questions were raised within his letter indicating concern with the square footage limitations for a retail use that would appear, a general retail use appearing in the MN or the MBP zoning districts. These are the replacements to the C1 and to the MC, our office park zoning district in the industrial areas. In that use-specific condition, inline or single-tenant stores are limited to a maximum square footage of 15,000 square feet, with the exception for a grocery store being allowed at 45,000 square feet. Mr. Linder expresses a concern that the wording is problematic and will result in a loss of property values as well as a regulatory taking for many properties in the community. As I indicated, MN is C1 today, and he indicates current C1 properties that have grocery store or retail stores in excess of these requirements include the Nifong Shopping Center, Rockbridge Shopping Center, Kohl's, Orchelands on South Providence, Hy-Vee on West Broadway, Crossroads Shopping Center, Stadium Plaza, and Westlake Ace Hardware. And then he specifically refers to property that Forum Development Group has, which include the Nifong Shopping Center, cannot redevelop under this requirement in event we lose our anchor store, GURBS. If that were to happen, the retailers we have spoken to are all in excess of 15,000 square feet, and it is unclear as to whether we could ever or even backfill GURBS with a new grocery store, as their footprint is currently 59,000 square feet. Suggestions as it relates to his concerns and questions are remove the limitation that is in use-specific standard AA completely, or rezone the above-listed properties to MC in conjunction with this ordinance. The MC zoning classification is the replacement to C3, which is our highway commercial zoning classification. So as we have discussed previously, uses that are existing today that are impacted by a code revision, such as a use-specific standard, are legal nonconformities. And as long as a similar use were replaced in that 59,000-square-foot tenant space, it would be a legally permitted replacement as long as that intensity did not increase. He has listed a series of very specific centers for my analysis of what we have here that may be more appropriately addressed on a case-by-case basis rather than a comprehensive elimination of the use-specific standards, which are really designed to ensure that we have neighborhood scale for neighborhood shopping centers. And that is why those standards currently exist. We are trying to ensure that if you're going to do neighborhood retail, that scale of that shopping center isn't equivalent to what we have at a Walmart or something else where there's no limitations associated to it. So with that comment, as well as my additional commentary on the comment that has been made, if you have any questions, I'll be more than happy to try to answer them for you.
Mr. McMahon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Linda's issues could be, to follow up on what you said, Mr. Lender's issues are because the stores and some of the sites, I don't agree with his list completely, abut neighborhoods, and the size limitations are to protect said neighborhoods, correct?
That would be correct. All right. These are currently C1
centers. With that in mind, if he were to do this a year from now when the code was in place, his relief would be to seek a zoning change, which would involve a public process with council and his neighbors, correct?
That would be correct.
Thank you, Mr. Manager Center.
Commissioners? Mr. Harder?
I was wanting you to clarify if we could use as example the Nifong Providence, I think it's the Nifong Shopping Center. The anchor store, if they were seeking a replacement, they would have a year to find an equal size replacement, and then after a year, what would happen?
If I recall correctly, the extension request for more than the 12 months, which is by right within the code, is through the Board of Adjustment. And again, I'd like to just reiterate that the marketability of that space, because it would be considered a legal nonconforming use for a similar use, wouldn't necessarily need to be a grocery store, but a use that has the same use intensity would be allowed within that space, even though it may exceed the square footage maximum. A 59,000 square foot space could be subdivided into three compliant 15,000 square foot retailing environments within the MN use-specific standard, and if a grocery store were to relocate there, it would be an identical use to what may have vacated that space, and the 59,000 square feet would be able to be permitted for that purpose.
Thank you.
Any additional discussion? Ms. Russell, Mrs. Russell.
Well, if there isn't any additional discussion, I would like to make a motion for the continuance of case 16-110, the UDC, to January 5th, 2017.
Second.
A motion has been made to move the additional discussion to January 5th on this case, and has been seconded by Ms. Lowe. Any additional discussion, commissioners, to move this to the January 5th meeting date? I see none. Mrs. Burns, when you're ready.
Mr. Tuohy.
Yes.
My vote is yes. Ms. Lowe.
Yes.
Mr. Harder.
Yes.
Mr. McMahon.
Yes.
Mr. Strodman.
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Rushing.
Yes.
Ms. Russell.
Yes.
Motion carries 8-0.
Thank you, Mrs. Burns. Much earlier than we thought. Okay, let me grab my agenda here. comments of the public.
Floor's back open.
Nope. See you next year, huh?
Yes, you, Mark.
Let's go another 3 hours.
Someplace else.
What else are we going to
do? comments of the staff. Mr. Zinner.
As we have spoken this evening, the January 5th meeting does have additional agenda items on it. We have previously presented those for you. We will handle regular business at 6 p.m. on your January 5th agenda with the continuation of 16-110 to be following that. 16-110 will be, the continuance of that will be the Commission's completion of its deliberations and then a likely or anticipated final vote on the Unified Development Code. And again, we will have a staff report and a updated errata sheet published on December 30th for that January 5th meeting. Any additional public comments that are desired to be submitted will be received, and they should be sent to my attention at my email address or delivered to our Community Development Department, third floor of City Hall. We will incorporate that in any public comment document that we produce. However, they will not be presented, they'll be presented at the public hearing on the 5th and then included in any correspondence forwarded to City Council. We appreciate your patience as we have moved through this process. We wish you all a Merry Christmas and a Happy Holidays. We are at least going to give you a break for 3 weeks, and staff will be busy preparing what you need for your January 5 meeting. Happy Holidays.
Mr. Zinner, just clarification, when will the errata sheet, the final errata sheet, be ready? Did you say the 30th?
December 30th is when we will publish the agenda for the January 5th meeting.
And that will be attached. Thank you.
That is correct.
Commissioners, comments? Commissioners?
I do.
Anybody would like to make a motion for adjournment?
I move to adjourn.
Mrs. Burns, thank you.
Second.
Mr. McMahon, thank you. All, any discussion on that? All in favor? Adjourn. Thank you all. Go.